lucky number. But at Health Alliance Plan, we found a new way to use the number one. Introducing Solo, powered by HAP. Solo is affordable and flexible health coverage for individuals and families. Whether you're graduating from college, self-employed, between jobs, retiring early, or just want better coverage for your loved ones, a Solo plan from HAP can give you what you want. Comprehensive plan designs include PPO options, health savings accounts, online enrollment, and above all, prices that fit your budget. So if you're looking for a great healthcare plan, go Solo and get powered by HAP today. You can learn more and apply for Solo at www.hap.org. That's www.hap.org. Solo products are offered through Alliance Health and Life Insurance Company, Inc., a wholly owned subsidiary of Health Alliance Plan.
You're on your way to a better day when you think Ford first.
Ford is the number one selling brand in Metro Detroit. And now, during the Ford Model Year Clearance, AC Plan customers and eligible family members can lease a 2006 Ford Freestyle for only $199 a month. It's a great deal with best-in-class fuel economy of up to 27 highway miles per gallon. And it comes with a third-row seat. Lease one now for only $199 a month. Only $199 a month for 24 months through Ford Credit with $2484 to its signing. Payment includes first month payment, a wage security deposit, and acquisition fees. Excludes title, taxes, and license fees. Some payments higher, some lower. Not elected will qualify. Residency restrictions apply. Taking retail delivery from dealer stock by 8/31/06. See dealer for details. Lease a Ford Freestyle crossover today for only $199 a month.
Your Metro Detroit Ford dealers.
Welcome to the award-winning Night Call, the Riff's phone-in talk show on 101 WRIF Detroit. Our number, 313-298-WRIF. Now, here's the host of Night Call, Peter Werby.
Well, thank you very much, and welcome to another Sunday here in Detroit as we broadcast Night Call. And Night Call is brought to you this hour by Waking Up. That's Metro Detroit's sweatshop free clothing store. It's located in the Universal Mall at 12 Mile Road in DeQuinder in Warren. And you can go online and see all their stuff at WakingUpStore.com. Remember, the Waking Up Green Expo, it's going to be out there at the Universal Mall all day Saturday, September 16th. Going to be green businesses, green organizations, you know, environmental groups and what have you. And I will be speaking at the Universal Mall in front of the Waking Up Store at 4 p.m. And my theme, you know, actually, maybe I'll change this because it sounds a little weird. The formal title of my talk is How I Stopped Recycling and Learned to Love It. And it sounds like some right-winger or anti-environmentalist, doesn't it? But it's got, you know, one of those kind of provocative titles. But hey, join us out there and also check out the Waking Up Store. Mike Kitchen, the proprietor, has very interesting stuff. And magazines and books and what have you. I want to give a big shout-out to the Riff promotion team, the WRIF promotion team. They've been out at Metro Park all day. Now they're over at Screamin' Scott's. I can't believe they're listening to this show, though. I mean, they must be pretty toasty by now. All right, well, terrible news. I mean, it's funny. I mean, think about all the terrible news that we get out of Iraq and other places in the Middle East, Africa. And yet somehow this hits real close to home, particularly for those of us who fly from time to time. A crashed plane took off from the wrong runway. A commuter jet mistakenly trying to take off from a runway that was too short crashed into a field Sunday and burst into flames. Lexington, Kentucky, the area, killing 49 people, lone survivor, co-pilot, in critical condition. And it reminded me of this article that I saw, one that I've also I brought back one I had last week. Oh, I probably will not be doing the show next week because it'll be Labor Day Sunday, and I usually get those holidays off. I haven't talked to my boss yet, Doug Podell, who's the co-host of Motor City Riffs that airs before this, but he almost always gives me this holiday off. No, I don't even necessarily want it, you know, but you know, what are you going to say? No, I don't want it off. Anyway, if you think about the war in Iraq, if you think about Katrina, all these disasters that are occurring, and then this article, experts warn U.S. is coming apart at the seams. And you go, huh? I don't know. Is it? Well, here's the article from the Newhouse News Service. In a pipeline shuts down in Alaska. Equipment failures disrupt air travel in Los Angeles. Electricity runs short at a spy agency in Maryland. This is incredible that the National Security Agency that's tapping all of our lines illegally, that Bush, you know, is shredding the Fourth Amendment, it's the intelligence world's electronic eavesdropping arm, is consuming so much electricity at its headquarters outside Washington that it is in danger of exceeding its power supply and could be knocked offline. Anyway, let's see what else. None of these recent events resulted from a natural disaster or terrorist attack, but they may as well have, some Homeland Security experts say. They worry that too little attention is paid to how fast the country's basic operating systems are deteriorating. You think, wait a minute, man. We're the richest country in the world, the most technologically advanced. We're number one, right? Although I'm always losing what we're number one at. I mean, militarily, we're not doing real well. That used to be the big number, right? Christian Beckner, a Washington analyst who runs the respected website Homeland Security Watch, says, when I see events like these, you know, the pipeline shutdown, the equipment failures, the whole parcel of them, I become concerned that we've lost focus on the core operational functionality of the nation's infrastructure and are becoming a fragile nation, which is just as bad, if not worse, as being an insecure nation. The American Society of Civil Engineers last year graded the nation a D, for its overall infrastructure conditions, estimating that it would take $1.6 trillion over 5 years to fix the problem. Boy, I wish I could do math, but it's about like what we're spending on this fool's journey in Iraq. So that's what we've given all our money to. Because this money that goes to Iraq, or it could go to fix our infrastructure, that's our tax dollars, right? Yours and mine, or your parents, or whoever. And so instead of making our place happen, run smoothly, run well, like we all deserve, all this money is just going down the rat hole to defense contractors and the like. And let's see, Casey Dingus, the Society's Managing Director of External Affairs, says, I thought Hurricane Katrina was a hell of a wake-up call, but the people are missing the alarm. Well, I don't think we're supposed to miss it or catch it. I'm sorry. I don't think we're supposed to catch it. Don't we pay some guys to do that? Don't we pay people to keep their eye on the ball? I mean, how in the hell are you or I supposed to have a fix on the entire American infrastructure and analyze it? I mean, I saw something, where was this here? But it was just talking about little things like potholes everywhere. Like we begin to just take those kind of things for granted. And they say the problem is the political system is geared to reacting to crises instead of averting them. Well, they don't do real well with that either, given Katrina. Some politicians don't see infrastructure as a federal responsibility. And many problems are out of sight for the public and out of mind. You see, the guy from the Society of Civil Engineers said, you see bridges and roads and potholes, but so much else is hidden, take it for granted. As a result, people don't just get stirred up and alarmed. And remember, I've been substituting on this national network, Air America Radio. So I may have read this, or I may have done it here as well. But some of these statistics, the United States, 49th in the world in literacy. So there's 48 countries ahead of us that are more literate. Yeah. The United States ranked 28th out of 40 countries in mathematical literacy. 28% of Americans think the sun orbits the earth. 17% believe the earth revolves around the sun once a day. Whew, man. World Health Organization, I think I did read this, ranked the countries of the world in terms of overall health performance, and the U.S. was 37th. In the fairness of health care, we're 54th. So we're not doing real well in some core stuff. U.S. childhood poverty. What would you think in the richest country in the world should be the number one in not having it, right? 22nd or second to last among developed countries. Only Mexico scores lower. And the person writing this has been to Mexico lately. Does it look developed to you? Yet it's the only developed country to score lower in childhood poverty. So we're sinking, folks. And, you know, sometimes I don't think that. I mean, I was fortunate enough to be born into the middle class and stay in this class. So I tend to circulate in those circles. Circulate in the circles, yeah. And so when I'm around Ferndale and Royal Oak and Birmingham and places like that, everything looks just kind of swell, doesn't it? And yet what these enormous pockets of poverty, urban areas, rural areas, small towns, United States 41st in infant mortality. Cuba scores higher. Women are 70% more likely to die in childbirth in America than in Europe. The leading cause of death of pregnant women in this country is murder. Of the 20 most developed countries in the world, the U.S. was dead last in the growth rate of total compensation to its workforce in the 1980s. That's you and me. 20 most developed countries. Does that include Mexico? Let me see. Well, they ranked 22nd. Maybe they didn't put those in that. This study didn't do it. So we were 20th. Where are we number one? Japan, China, Taiwan, and South Korea hold 40% of our government debt. Want to go over that one again? I've talked about this a lot. When we pay our taxes, it's not just going just for blowing it down a rat hole of spending for war and stuff like that. It is also going to pay the debt service on the loans for the government debt as Bush Co. Drove us into debt from having a surplus. So now China, Japan, Taiwan, and South Korea hold 40% of our debt. And this goes on and on and on like this. Americans are now spending more money on gambling than on movies, videos, DVDs, music, and books combined. One out of four Americans believe that using violence to get what they want is acceptable. Man. Number one, this is an article called Number One, America by the Numbers by Michael Ventura, and it appeared in City Pages, at citypages.com, maybe LA, I don't know, I can't remember. No, this was reprinted from the Austin Chronicle. I think City Pages owns it. He asked, number one, in most important categories, we're not even in the top 10 anymore, not even close. The USA is number one in nothing but weaponry, consumer spending, debt, and delusion. The delusion is that we're still number one. Of course, how are things being handled at the top? You know, I didn't even give her a phone number. What am I doing? This is a talk show, and it includes me and you. 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. And the way we do things here, if you're just joining me, is to jump in. At any moment. And all right, so who's taking care of things at the top? Well, you know who that is. Here's an item in U.S. News and World Report. It's been largely ignored by the mainstream press. And it was a report in this fairly conservative, I guess of the three, U.S. News and World Report is the most conservative over Newsweek and Time. Here's what they say. Bush loves to amuse himself by openly passing gas in front of White House aides. I mean, I'm not making this up. Apparently, his biggest thrill is, and we're quoting from U.S. News and World Report, quote, he is also known to cut a few for laughs, especially when greeting new young aides. So we have a farting president as everything goes to hell. And this is typical of rich frat boy behavior. Gonna cut loose some farts for laughs. In the meantime, everything is going to hell in a handbasket, except of course, for his pals, the haves and the have-mores. Things are just going swimmingly for them. But for lots of other people here in America, it's not quite the idea of what's going on. That is going well. It says here, and this is from BuzzFlash.com, farting for fun to humiliate new young White House staffers isn't just passing gas. It's a disgrace to the American people in the White House. We guess this is what Republicans mean when they claim Bush brought back honor and dignity to the White House. So what, I don't know, which is worse, cutting loose in front of White House aides or getting a BJ? Or maybe we need a big broom. Should we go on with this? I don't know. Let me see. Got, well, one thing. I'm going to let that one go. Oh, yeah. I just got a little beef. I mean, yeah, I'm trying to be more modern. I'm old school. You couldn't even say hell when I started. And now, of course, they're backing up. They can't say a lot of stuff. But I say I have a bitch. We have a, this is a talk show, and I don't think everyone agrees with me. And when, say, at like the beginning of things, when Bush stole the election in 2000, at the same time I was doing this job, I was doing this nationally syndicated show, and I lost station after station because of speaking my mind. People would say, you can't call the President of the United States a liar. You can't call him Bush Co., you know, Bush and Sons Incorporated and all that, and on and on. And our program director, Doug Podell, would get all this email saying, on this show, why are you letting him say that, that Iraq had nothing to do with 9-1-1 and we're not fighting terror, but this is a war for oil? And, in fact, he would laughingly say to me, boy, you really must have been on last night. I got four or five emails. And I said, well, gee. And he said, don't worry about it. It's fine. So that actually really cheeses me. For one thing, that no one's going to cut me loose out of here because of my opinions. I'm supposed to give my opinions. And if you don't like them, well, you got one of, actually, here's the choice. I don't want to say another one. You call 313-298-WRIF or 313-298-9743. You don't go tattling to the teacher. And that's what a lot of guys do. I don't think any women have ever even done it. But it doesn't have a great effect on the management here. They know me. Most of them are my pals for 25 years and all that. And I ain't going away. So save your email or send it to me. Engage me. Say, I don't agree with you. Or you lied. They always say that. I lie. I'm reading from stuff. You know, it lied. I'm maybe repassing along lies without knowing it, but I believe these to be the truth, and they're in mainstream news reports. Or I have opinions. And then you don't agree with my opinions. So is mine worth more than yours? No. I get to give it because it's my show. That's the nature of this medium. And is it fair? No. I get a bigger voice even when I invite you to call in. But do that. 313-298-WRIF. Or write the management. I don't give a damn. I mean, it doesn't do you any good. Here's a typical one. Joseph wrote in. Actually, he was nice enough to send me a copy. These guys don't even do that because I'm always curious. And actually, when people write in, and sometimes they write all in caps, you know, just screaming, you're the stupidest, you know, like that. Or people write in and tell me, I've been to your website, which is somebody wrote me a little while ago, Peter Werbe, P-E-T-E-R-W-E-R-B-E, peterwerbe.com. And they said, I saw your photograph, and you're one of the ugliest people I've ever seen. I feel sorry for your mother. And I'm going, man, I really know how to hurt a guy. Or someone wrote in and said, you have the worst voice I've ever heard on the air. How do you have the nerve to open the mic? I mean, save that. I can't even begin to tell you how little effect that has on me or anybody in broadcasting. Or anybody in broadcasting, right? Sometimes we even believe, and sometimes it's true, that it's people from other stations trying to make the broadcaster nervous. But everybody on this station are pros, including me. I've been doing this a long time. So it doesn't bother me. If you, whatever negative you say about me as a person, who cares? So the other thing is, and people scream, you're stupid, you ought to go back to, well, you can't even go back anywhere. But all these, then maybe they'll say, well, I disagree with you because blah, 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 blah. Sometimes I get so much email, I can't answer it all. But sometimes it intrigues me, and I say, have you ever read this? Or, yes, you say that, but da-da-da. And then usually the exchange gets a little more civil. But, I mean, don't look forward to that. I don't have a lot of time to, I mean, I'd have to be writing back to 100 or 200 people a week. But here's what Joseph wrote. On Peter Werbe's broadcast this evening, which was last week, he asserted several comments regarding Israel as true, while in fact his insertions were entirely false, which is his view. I was reading stuff some of which was from Israeli and Jewish peace groups, but whatever. Not only did he say that Israel is in violation of UN sanctions, which, I mean, how can you dispute that? It's a fact. He made the atrocious claim that Israel ethnically cleansed their geographic area. Well, there's Jewish writers that say that as well. So then he goes on a whole thing about what happened during World War II. And he says, this supposed disc jockey. Someone's asking me, do I play music anymore? And I go, nah, you know, I used to do like this overnight show called the Riff Rock Cafe, which was really cool. But anyways, he doesn't even call me a talk show host. If this supposed disc jockey continues to make asinine claims like he did tonight, I would recommend that you remove him from your airwaves. Not I will call him and confront him and bring him the truth as I see it to counter his false claims, but rather I recommend you remove him from your airways. Moreover, I believe he should issue an on-air apology, and the station should closely monitor his vernacular. Now, that's not a body part. That's, I don't even know. It's not even really used right here. But what is with this guy? Hey, Joseph, you know, write me or call me. The phones are here at 313-298-WRIF. All right. We've... usually I rant on for about another 10 minutes. I've got tons of stuff to talk about, but I suspect you do as well. So let's go to your calls, and there is actually an open line or two that you can grab, and I got to push some buttons here, and we will go to Bill's in Columbus, Michigan. Bill, it's Peter Werby. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hey, Peter. How are you doing? Peter, I think maybe some of your listeners might like to hear how gasoline prices have gone.
What?
Maybe some of your listeners might like to know how gasoline prices are made.
Oh, how gasoline prices are made. Yeah, okay. I mean, we all know. Rich guys sit around and they decide how they can fleece us, right?
Well, every one of us could be commodity traders if we wanted to.
Commodity traders. You think every one of us could be commodity traders?
If we could come up with $50,000 to $100,000 each, we could.
Oh, okay. Well, I knew there was a catch.
But if we figure the price of gas is going up to $2, we buy it at $1, we made a dollar profit.
Yeah, man. Well, that's capitalism.
And there's 42,000 gallons to a contract.
Yeah?
So if you can, one day you can make $42,000 real fast, or you could lose $42,000.
Yeah?
Another thing people don't know, Peter, is that the Federal Reserve is not a government organization.
What? The Federal Reserve is not a government agency? I mean, all my life I've been working under this delusion, thinking that this wonderful banking operation is in fact a government agency, and it's not?
It's not.
Yeah.
It has
the capacity to regulate federal currency. No, I didn't know that. I know where you're going with this. This is the money nut trajectory where that somehow everything was cool in the United States till 1912 when they formed the Federal Reserve Act. It's kind of a semi-official institution that is the key to banking in this country, and the fact that it's a private enterprise. It's not even an enterprise. I don't think they make a profit, but that's what banks need. If it wasn't for that, the banking system couldn't even exist. All right, Bill, thanks for edifying us on all that. I appreciate it. 313-298-WRIF. Here is Jimmy in St. Clair Shores. Hi, Jimmy. You're on the air. Hey, Jimmy, turn your radio off. Well, all right, here's what we're going to do. We're going to put Jimmy back on hold, and let's make sure that we can find out whether they're hearing the calls on hold, because you should not be listening to your radio. You should be listening to the show on the phone. Here's Joe in Farmington Hills. Joe, hi, it's Peter Werby. You're on the air.
Hey, Peter, how are you?
Yeah, can you hear the program on hold?
Can I what?
Can you hear the program when you're on hold?
I just turned it down, but yeah, I can hear it.
When you were listening on the phone, could you hear it on hold?
No, I couldn't hear anything.
Oh, that's bad. Okay.
Yeah, there wasn't even anything on at all.
All right, go ahead. What's on your mind?
Well, no, I just wanted to say I typically vote Republican and consider myself kind of a leaning more Republican guy. I went to University of Michigan.
Still?
But I think,
after all this?
I just think you're a necessary evil. I think without people speaking liberally, without people being liberal and speaking about the problems in society, especially what you just said about, you know, 20 minutes ago about our health care and the schools, and I was blessed like yourself to be born in a upper middle class family or middle class, whatever you want to call it. And I've never had to, like, you know, worry about food or, you know, having a roof over my head, but I go downtown on the weekends and I have friends who weren't so fortunate to be born in the right families. I mean, and I just think it's necessary for people to continuously bring that up, because the Bush administration and a lot of Republicans, they don't choose to see it.
Right.
They ignore it.
Well, let me tell you this, Joe. I mean, I don't consider myself a Democrat. I consider myself a person who is concerned with trying to make the world a better place. And One thing that's happening, you know, in your area, Farmington Hills, you're represented by this Bush clone named Joe Nolenberg, and there's a woman running for his seat that used to be a colleague of mine on the IE America radio network named Nancy Springer. You can go to springerforcongress.com, and I would highly recommend getting somebody else new in there that's going to bring up some of those issues. So I appreciate that. Thank you very much. 313-298-WRIF. Let's see. Let's go back to Jimmy. Jimmy, hi. You're on the air. Sorry. I guess we're going to have to make some adjustments, and we'll get the show on hold.
Okay.
Go ahead. You're on the air. Turn your radio off, please.
I will. Just one second.
Okay. Probably like two rooms away. All right. What am I supposed to do in the meantime?
Yeah, Peter, I'm a long-time listener.
Yeah, thanks.
Really respect you, and I know you're well-read.
What?
Which we were saying about the infrastructure and the national debt.
Yeah.
I've known this for decades. They've been ignoring that for years, decades, the infrastructure. And how much money does the federal government collect each year? Like $2 trillion?
I know, a lot of money. I'm actually not sure, to tell you the truth, which I always would, I'm not sure what the figures are at all. Maybe someone, see, then when you have producers and writers and researchers, somebody just comes up with this immediately for you and flashes it on the screen so the talk show host sounds like they know everything. Well, I don't know everything, but I'll bet you there's people out there that do that can give us a call.
Well, what I don't understand is how can, you know, they call us the richest country in the world when we're in debt, what, $8 trillion?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I don't know. Actually, I don't know. I don't know. Someone ought to get those figures. We're deep in debt, and we're deep in doo-doo.
I understand that.
Yeah, but I don't have the figures. Someone can call us on it, or they can write to calltalkyes@yahoo.com as well.
Have you written any books?
No, but I'll tell you, there's going to be a collection of essays that I've written that are going to be out probably in a couple months. I'll let people know.
I'd love to get that.
Yeah, I'll be sure to tell people. Damn.
And who wrote Fiasco about the Iraq? The author.
You know, Jimmy, I could learn to hate you. You keep asking me these questions. I don't know the answers to.
Well,
no, I'm only kidding.
Again,
I'm only kidding.
That's okay because. I mean, I'm 48 years old, and I can't believe this country hasn't learned its lesson from Korea to Vietnam to the current situation, you know, especially the last two or three. You can't fight an enemy that you can't see.
And you can't fight an enemy in a country where it's their country.
That's what I'm saying.
And what the hell are we doing over there trying to change their government? I mean, we changed the whole, of course, the mission was to...
get Osama.
No, that wasn't. Osama was the wrong part of the world.
Definitely.
Yeah. I mean, and even Bush now admits, I don't know how he ran that out suddenly, but you know, after so many times of trying to link Iraq and 9/11, he said just the other day, where is it? But he said that there is no link whatsoever. Hey, wait a minute. Here it is. He said, nobody has suggested in this administration that Saddam Hussein ordered the attack on 9/11. Yet now half the people, again, think that there's a connection between Iraq and 9/11, which is absolute...
Absurd.
All right, let me get another call before my break. Fiasco, someone call in, let us know, because that's a best-selling book about how the fiasco being the Iraq War. All right, thanks a lot. Appreciate it. Up to Flint with Mike. Mike, hi, it's Peter Werby on WRIF, and you're on the air.
Hey, how you doing?
Good.
I have a question for you. okay, I heard something on Nightline about Nazis, and these two young ladies, about maybe 11 years old, they're calling themselves the Olsen twins, but they're singing Nazi songs.
Oh, yeah, you know, I saw something about that a few months ago, yeah.
Yeah, I was wondering, like, what's your opinion on that, because it's just outrageous, you know?
Well...
And the mother is supporting it, and, like, what the hell, you know? Like, I don't know.
Well, of course. I mean, that you see that kind of hatred being instilled to young children who take the word of adults. And when we think we've finally gotten beyond that kind of racial hatred and ethnic prejudices and what have you, and it rears its head in this grotesque way, young girls singing, and they're just these pretty young girls, and they're singing like Nazi songs. I mean, somebody said, I don't know, along the line, somewhere along the line, that Hitler's thousand-year Reich only suffered a momentary setback with the defeat of Nazi Germany. I mean, it's a pretty frightening thought. But that's why it's important that we never let ourselves fall into the trap of racial prejudice or stereotyping or whatever, and sometimes they're scapegoating, and it's real easy. It's real easy to do because it doesn't require any great amount of thinking. You just say, oh, they always, and anytime you hear that, you know you got a problem. All right, thank you very much. I got to go to a break, but in the meantime, there's room for you to call in. 313-298-WRIF.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with more of your calls right after this.
Tired of shopping for clothes from companies that use sweatshop labor to produce them? Well, check out the Waking Up store at the Universal Mall in Warren. Waking Up stocks sweatshop-free clothing for men and women and carries U.S.-made and union-made jeans and shirts. Yes, real American-made blue jeans. They also carry clothes made from eco-fabrics such as organic cotton and hemp. They require no pesticides or insecticides to grow, and hemp resists mildew and bacteria and is more durable and breathable than cotton. All of Waking Up's eco-fiber vendors are Co-op America approved, which means they've gone through Co-op America's screening process and are clean, green, and sweatshop free. Waking Up carries free trade coffee, chocolate, and accessories. They also have a media section with books and magazines and a community bulletin board. So check out Waking Up at the Universal Mall in Warren on 12 Mile in DeQuinder, or visit their website at WakingUpStore.com. They're waking up. Are you?
Your Metro Detroit Lincoln Mercury dealers present One Tank Wonders, featuring the 2007 Mercury Mariner, the stylish compact SUV that gets a whopping 429 miles on one 16.5-gallon tank of gas. So, what can you discover on One Tank?
Yeah, we're going to renew our wedding vows at Mystery Spot in St. Ignace.
Mystery Spot?
Where the strange magnetic powers under the Earth defy the laws of gravity.
And that's romantic because...
She's imbalanced.
She's unstable.
Warped.
Magnetic.
Attractive.
Irresistible.
Okay, and your Mariner's the way to go.
Oh, yeah, it's a long drive and it's got a great stereo.
Super comfortable leather seating.
Reverse sensing system.
Great little pockets and nooks for maps and snacks.
And over 62 cubic feet of cargo space for all the rest of your goodies.
Exactly.
And One Tank will take you to your place of happiness.
Of mystery.
Oddity.
Freak of nature.
One of a kind.
Soulmate.
Visit your Metro Detroit Lincoln Mercury dealer or LMAplan.com and check out the 2007 Mercury Mariner and discover your own One Tank wonders. You've got to put Mercury on your list. EPA estimated miles per gallon, 23 city, 26 highway. Mariner convenience, front wheel drive.
Bell Tire presents...
I come from a simpler time when Palm Pilot was a nickname you received upon entering puberty.
Dennis Miller, live.
You know, if you can't fit the seatbelt in a car around your waist, a head-on collision is like the least of your health concerns, all right?
September 3rd at DTE Energy Music Theater.
I was on eBay the other day. I saw a series of crushed black velvet paintings of drug-sniffing dogs playing poker, and, it's pretty sad. They had a little shih tzu completely baked on PCP.
The five-time Emmy Award winner.
Profiling? 15 out of 19 people from one country. That's not profiling. That's minimally observant.
Tickets are on sale now at PalaceNet.com. The Palace and DTE Energy Music Theater box offices and all Ticketmaster outlets are charged by phone. Lawn seats, just $10.
Dennis, don't be so uptight. Come on, man.
Don't miss Dennis Miller.
Part of the Bell Tire Concert Series.
All righty then, just a trim today? Sounds good.
What are you doing?
Oops, sorry, I'm kind of in a hurry.
Oops, that's my hair.
Well, you see, I've got my eye on a Chevy car, and if I don't get it soon, you know, someone else will.
The Chevy Model Year End Event is here. Qualified GM Employee Program participants get a low mileage lease on an 06 Malibu 2LT for $149 a month for 27 months with $1,579 due at signing. No security deposit required. Includes all offers. Mileage charge of 25 cents per mile over 22,500 miles. Tax, title, license, and dealer fees extra. Residency restrictions apply. Call 1-800-950-CHEV for details. That's a low mileage lease on an 06 Malibu 2LT for $149 a month.
But my hair!
Oh, don't worry. Listen, short hair makes you look a lot taller.
Really?
The Chevy Model Year-End Event. Claim yours before they're gone. Chevy drives the Motor City. See your Detroit area Chevy dealer today.
Did you know that Blue Cross Blue Shield of Michigan has more healthcare plans within your reach than ever before, offering unsurpassed access with the security and peace of mind so important to you? Blue Cross Blue Shield of Michigan, a nonprofit corporation and independent licensee of the Blue Cross and Blue Shield Association.
Double your summertime savings and fun at Speedway with double Speedy Rewards points on food and merchandise purchases. The Speedy Rewards Card. It's fast, free, and easy. And now through August 31st at Speedway, you'll get double points on food and merchandise purchases. Double points offer good on food and merchandise only and excludes gas. Double your summertime savings and fun. Just ask Speedway store manager Andrew Ames.
Get double points with your Speedy Rewards Card. You've got my word on it.
Fun, 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 the convenience stores of Speedway.
Now at Speedway, get the most out of summertime fun with two Jumbo Oscar Mayer hot dogs for just $2 with all new fresh condiments plus free chili and cheese.
We're on your way, the convenience stores of Speedway.
Now, Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
All right, thank you very much. Welcome back. Another segment of WRIF's Night Call. You can join in 313-298-WRIF, 313-298-9743. We're completely open line. And I was talking with some of our colleagues, fellow workers in the hallway, about sexual harassment. And I, before we get back to the phones, let me just tell you about this. This was in the New York Times of August 27th, which is today. Right. This was in Haditha Dam in Iraq. Remember, Haditha is where those Marines are accused of slaughtering those civilians, but I don't know if this is the exact same location. But here's the story. I'm not going to give you the headline. I'll just let it kind of wend its way out. One by one, the Marines took the stage for one of the most coveted photo opportunities of the war. Tania sat on the knee of an eager Marine while Lori rested on the other. Hands on their mini-skirted hips, Amber and Renee posed at each side. Denny stood behind and held the Marine's rifle as the camera snapped the photo. Some of the young Marines who lined up for the memento were so mesmerized by the experience that they had to be reminded not to leave their weapon behind. Mesmerized. The Haditha Dam is in a hostile stretch of the Euphrates River, 140 miles northwest of Baghdad, where the Marines do battle with insurgents in the oppressive heat. And, you know, in the New York Times every day, they have world temperatures. And routinely, these days, 120 in Baghdad. And think about how the U.S. soldiers are dressed with their armor and everything. But for a few hours this summer, the Chow Hall inside the dam was transformed into a theater for five shapely dancers who seemed to embody many a young Marine's fantasies. And at Haditha Dam, the Marines have the perfect angels, perfect being P-U-R-R-F-E-C-T. As the dancers are known, the tours, which organized, say, are paid by the military, have occasionally stirred some controversy. During the group's 2005 visit to Baghdad, a female Air Force officer complained that the dancers' wardrobes and routines encouraged insensitive attitudes towards women in the military. Well, I think it's way beyond that. If you've read at all the amount of rapes that are going on in the military, sexual harassment, and what have you, a recent show began with an entreaty. That means, you know, well, never mind. By a diligent sergeant who saw the event as an opportunity to appeal to the Marines to re-enlist. He was loudly shouted down. An announcer who was traveling with the dance group told the Marines not to pay any attention to news media reports that the American public did not support the war. The nation, she said, was solidly behind them. Well, that's not what the nation is solidly behind the troops. If someone said, do you support the troops? Yeah, but do you support our oops? The Bush oops? going into Iraq? I don't think so. Not anymore. About 2-1 against. But the dancers in revealing outfits energetically performed dance routines that were more rousing than most Super Bowl halftime acts. All right, so we got that bit of information. That's nice to know. We're paying for that. But here's another a little companion piece to it from Charleston, South Carolina. Female cadets report assaults at the Citadel. What percentage of cadets, female cadets at the Citadel, this military training college, would you think were sexually harassed or assaulted? Not harassed, not saying, hey, baby, or something like that. Assaulted. 20%. 20% of the female cadets at the Citadel last spring reported they had been sexually assaulted since enrolling at the military college. 4% of the male cadets reported being sexually assaulted. There's a culture here. I don't know what to say. Well, I do. I'm not, but maybe you could say it, particularly guys and any of you women who have been in the military. Jump in on this subject. 313-298-WRIF. Most of the reported incidents involving women happened in the barracks or elsewhere on campus, and the alleged perpetrator was another cadet. 68% of the women reported one or more incidents of sexual harassment, including sexual stories, jokes, and offensive remarks. This is amazing. I just can't imagine a woman going into the service facing all this. How about this? More than 100 young women who expressed interest in joining the military in the past year were preyed upon sexually by their recruiters. Women were raped on recruiting office couches, assaulted in government cars, and groped en route to entrance exams. 80 military recruiters have been disciplined last year for sexual misconduct with potential enlistees, and I would suspect that if their 80 were caught, what's the number that have gone unreported? The AP, the Associated Press, also found the Army, which accounts for almost half of the military, has had 722 recruiters accused of rape and sexual misconduct since 1996. That's 100 a year. Most recruiters found guilty of sexual misconduct are disciplined administratively, facing a reduction in rank. Military or civilian prosecutions are rare, it says. The increase in sexual sexual misconduct incidents is consistent with overall recruiter wrongdoing, which has increased from just over 400 cases in 2004 to 630 cases in 2005. So there's military recruiters were caught committing 630 cases of misconduct. And again, how many didn't? Who committed them and didn't get pulled up on it? The Pentagon has committed more than $1.5 billion to recruiting efforts this year. And just the final thing, this is actually an old couple. Well, I got all of these here. Might as well run them by you. Hate groups are infiltrating the military a decade after the Pentagon declared a zero-tolerance policy for racist hate groups, recruiting shortfalls. And, gee, I wonder why there's a recruiting shortfall, particularly among women, caused by the war in Iraq has allowed, quote, large numbers of neo-Nazis and skinhead extremists to infiltrate the military. The group quoted a Defense Department investigator is saying in a report, we've got Aryan Nations graffiti in Baghdad. Wow. And also, back to the recruiters, Defense Department investigator says, recruiters are knowingly allowing neo-Nazis and white supremacists to join the armed forces, and commanders don't remove them from the military, even when we positively identify them as extremists or gang members. Well, they're probably too busy sexually harassing and raping women. And people are leaving since 2000. How many troops do you think have deserted since 2000? 40,000. 40,000 troops have deserted from the U.S. Armed Forces. And there's a few of them, and you've seen them in the paper lately, that that have said they won't fight in Iraq because they think it's an illegal war. But Lieutenant Colonel Brian Hefferty says the vast majority of soldiers who desert do so for personal, family, or financial problems, not for political or conscientious objector purposes. Well, don't you think that maybe it's kind of a personal reason that I don't want to go to Iraq and get shot? I could imagine that. All right, let's continue onward. 313, personal experiences in this would really be appreciated. 313 298-WRIF, 313-298-9743, or you can email us at calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Why do I say we? I have a mouse in my pocket. All right, here's Tom on WRIF calling from Ann Arbor. Hey, Tom, it's Peter Werby. How are you?
Hey, good, Peter. How are you?
Doing great. Thanks.
Your last comments are actually kind of hit home with me. I wasn't expecting it while I was on hold, but I'm 22 years old. I joined the United States Marine Corps. I went and signed up shortly after 9/11 on it's a program where the early entry program.
Sure.
You enter and you have a year to join. Well, I joined the Marine Corps, and all the things that you just spoke of there, I witnessed and experienced all of them. From inside my recruiter's office, there was I'm not going to specify which post, but
good. Yeah.
There was a man who was a former Marine who was a local in town, and he was an extreme racist. Spoke negatively about black people daily, over and over, to young kids coming in there thinking it's cool. And in this office, this particular office, they have camouflage netting in front of the desk, so you can't see behind the desk.
Uh-huh.
And I swear to God, at least two or three girls between the ages of 18 and 21 in there all day. The recruiter bragging, showing pictures of the girls' genitalias. Absolutely disgusting, actually. And as far as the treatment of women,
yeah.
I can't speak for the rest of the United States Armed Forces, but the Marine Corps, from the minute you join the Marine Corps, you're separated, female and male. And let me tell you, the desecration of women is disgusting. It's programmed into their heads. I mean, it's okay to cheat on your wife. It's awesome. It's bragged about. I consider myself a slightly intelligent person, and pretty individual minded. And this whole the whole experience just sickened me. And
are you still in? Are you on active duty?
No, sir. I joined active duty, but during the delayed entry program, I converted to reserve duty. And thank God.
So yeah, but wasn't there a chance you're going to get called up though, eh?
No, I actually got a general discharge under other than honorable conditions. I failed a urinalysis test.
Yeah.
Yes, my section for my unit, local unit, was due to depart in a couple months, and we had a urinalysis test, and I don't really like to talk about that. But
well, I don't blame you. But listen, I really appreciate your story on that. Thanks a lot. Oh yeah, did I say that again? I said that. Oh, I said Nancy Skinner's name wrong. I've done that. I've done that about 10 times. Yeah, it's the woman running against Joe Nolenberg in the Michigan 9th Congressional District is Nancy Skinner, not the other name that I said that is the name of another talk show host. Oh, my dumb. I hope, Nancy, if you're listening, I hope it wasn't you that called. Anyway, it's SkinnerForCongress.com. SkinnerForCongress.com, not the name that I said. And we're also looking for the author's name of Fiasco, about the Iraq War and its origins. And James from Kenosha, Wisconsin, wrote into calltalkyes@yahoo.com. It was Thomas Ricks, R-I-C-K-S, who's the Washington Post military reporter. And James says, great insight on the incompetence of the Bush administration and to a lesser degree the militant American military. Despite the heartbreaking outrage of the story, it's a page-turner. Okay. All right, let's go back to our phones. 313-298-WRIF, 313-298-9743. And here's Will in Windsor. Will, it's Peter Werby. Thanks for making our show international.
Oh, thank you very much, Peter, but I'm sorry, your last comments actually just stole my thunder. I was just calling to inform you about the author of the book, Fiasco. And
have you read it?
Yes, I have.
Yeah. Do you agree with...
It was very good. It takes you up to about March of 2005, and then there's a postscript for 2006, but it's done by... He's actually a Washington Post Pentagon correspondent. He had an earlier work called Making the Core, so he's really up to date on military matters.
Uh-huh.
And it's really, really a good book. And probably a good companion piece to that for any for those of you that are interested in the inside military story. You've probably covered this before. Is Cobra 2 by Michael Gordon and General Bernard E. Traynor, who are both active duty commanders in Iraq. Cobra 2 is a little more in detail with the military aspects. But of course, they're both highly critical. They're not tell-all books. They're actually well documented, very good, astute military analysis. And just one more, if I could just
sure, please, Will, go ahead.
I'm a book freak. I buy all this stuff, but I read a really good one. I still have it. It's my favorite I've read over the last 4 years about American foreign policy and the Middle Eastern wars. And it's called America Alone, and it's the neoconservatives and the global order. I know there's a lot of books out there on the shelves, but this one really stands out. It's written by Stephen Halper and Jonathan Clark, and what's interesting about it is they're both active duty Republicans. They both served in Bush 1, in your 41st president, as well as in the Clinton administration. And they were both foreign policy experts, and they read a fantastic book called America Alone. And it's basically how the Bush administration has alienated diplomatic allies throughout the world, and why they have and how they have, and the repercussions of that.
Hey, well, so, you know where's a great place? I don't know if you ever checked this out, but it's buzzflash.com. And they get books, and they partly use it for fundraising. They're no more expensive than they would be like on Amazon, except it's going to help this great website, buzzflash.com. And they always have tons of great books. And in fact, one of my colleagues, Tom Hartman, has a brand new book, collection of his essays, and I think I'm going to get him on as a guest pretty soon. All right, Will, thanks again for making the show international. I appreciate that. And Jay Hudson, our producer, has a note here on the screen. Someone called and wants you to play the Perfect Circle song that you play once in a while, which is their version of Imagine. But that always have this kind of a contest between the original John Lennon, the Perfect Circle, Maynard and from Tool, and also George Bush singing Imagine. You've never heard that? Maybe I should. I don't like to keep repeating things, but at least the George Bush one. Or you can hear it for yourself. Go to the website, thepartyparty.com. They also have that great song I play once in a while called Dick is a Killer. That's a good one. And I actually haven't played much from that recently, but probably should. Okay, let's see. Is this over in Holland, Michigan? Ryan, hi. It's Peter Werby. You're on the air. Are you calling from Holland, Michigan? Ryan, let me see. What am I doing here? Are you with me? Boy, this just sounds dead. Let me see. I'm going to put that on hold. Oh, no, he must have hung up. Maybe it was from, once in a while. Remember Jacob from calling from Oulu, Finland? It's not so expensive anymore. So maybe he was calling from, the Finland. Here is Larry in Detroit. Larry, hi, it's Peter Werby. You're on the air.
Hi, Peter.
Hi.
I have a comment and a question. My comment is I'm 40, and I was in the service for 8 years from 85 to 93, and I never seen any kind of sexual harassment during that time. And it's kind of disappointing to hear all these numbers that you're spitting out about the conduct of men.
Could that have gone downhill that quickly? I've never been in, so I don't know. I'm just reading the stuff.
Yeah, I mean, all the people I was surrounded by were, pretty upstanding guys, and either that or I just didn't see it.
Well, were there a lot of women in the service while you were there?
They were coming in more and more.
Yeah.
It was getting to be more female-friendly, and that's just amazing.
It would seem to me that there'd have to be tight rein on that, because if you get a lot of testosterone-driven young guys who are late teens, early 20s, mid-20s, and a lot of women from that same age category, that's when kind of the Mother Nature drive is kind of making all the hormones active. But people have to have appropriate sense of behavior. Plus, you're in a war zone. You're maybe over there for your third tour. There's people going over there for their fourth tour.
Right.
There's certainly no sexual outlets out there. And there's been, I guess, a large number of pregnancies, too. One can understand that. I mean, that consenting adults fall in love or in lust, and I don't know.
My question is, a friend of mine loaned me a DVD, and part of it had to do with the hunt for the Boeing. It was an internet deal, and it talked about the planes that crashed into the trade towers and, you know, kind of how it got everything going. I was wondering, I mean, do you feel like any of the, that the attacks on 9/11 were a conspiracy where our own government might have did that to start a war?
Was this called Loose Change?
Loose Change. I don't know. It was kind of like a documentary.
Right. No, I saw it. Someone sent it to me. Well, here's what I thought. The whole thing rests on this premise that is a lot of nonsense. That if the Pentagon and the and what crashed in Pennsylvania were not airliners but rather missiles, then you got to ask, well, what happened to those flights? And so they showed in it. They landed at Cleveland. Well, where are the passengers? They're being held in, where do they hold the aliens? Sector
36.
I mean, so it falls down. There's a lot of unanswered questions. And certainly all of 9/11 was manipulated by Bush and Cheney and Rumsfeld and the rest of them as a way in which to carry out their long-held plans to reshape the Middle East with what they call American hegemony. In other words, domination in that region so that they could control political events there and control oil, which most people agree is going to be a pretty scarce resource in the years to come. So do I think it was a government conspiracy to actually plan and carry out? I know people are going to think I'm part of the conspiracy when I say no, but I think that they knew, they being the Bush Co. Members, that something was coming because Osama bin Laden had threatened. And I think that what they said is soon, the next time we're hit, we're going into Afghanistan, we're going to see if we can make an Iraq connection because we are on the move. Well, yeah, and we've seen what that's all brought us. All right, thank you very much. I got to take a break. Right back after these.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with more of your calls right after this.
It's time to live the mortgage experts. 800-333-ROCK.
Hey, it's August 2006. I'm David Hall with another exclusive from the mortgage experts at Rock Financial. And we know you're going to love this one. It's Move Easy. That's right. You'll have no interest payments for up to 6 months after you purchase your new home. We call it Move Easy, and it's exclusive to the mortgage experts at Rock Financial. This program is amazing. It's a win-win for both the seller and for the buyer. The seller's going to sell their home faster, and the buyer's going to have no interest payments for up to 6 months. Call Rock Financial today. Ask about the Move Easy. Let's get Michigan moving. Call Rock Financial today.
It's time to live.
A Quicken Loans Company, equal housing lender, seller participation required. Go to rockfinancial.com for details.
Thanks to my mom, my tuition was set with Met.
Lock in your child's college tuition costs at today's rates with Michigan Education Trust, the state's guaranteed tuition program. With tuition costs rising at more than 2 times the rate of inflation, a Met contract is a secure investment in a child's future. The sooner you invest, the better. Even when they're babies, make sure their college educations are set. Met contracts have flexible benefits and payment options and can be purchased by parents, grandparents, or businesses. They're also state tax deductible and guaranteed by Michigan Education Trust. Invest in peace of mind. Make sure their college tuition is set with Met. For details or to enroll online, go to met4kid.com. Met4Kid.com or call 1-800-MET-4-KID.
Because of the Met contract, I was able to buy my first home 6 months after college.
Michigan Education Trust. Tomorrow's tuition set with Met.
Guten Tag. And now it's Ask Dr. Z with me, Daimler Chrysler Chairman Dieter Zetsche. Jim in Phoenix, what do you need to know?
Hey, Dr. Z, big fan. Look, Chrysler's got a lot of great vehicles, but what have you done to improve quality?
At Chrysler, we don't hide quality behind outstanding design. That would be like wearing one of those t-shirts that looks like a tuxedo. That's why we made Chrysler Town & Country beautiful inside and out. And quality is what earned Chrysler Pacifica the government's 5-star frontal crash test rating. We've won so many quality awards since the merger, I finally broke down and bought a real tuxedo for those award shows.
What did you wear before?
I wore lederhosen. It's a German thing. You wouldn't understand.
Well-qualified Daimler Chrysler employee lessees get a low-mileage lease on a 2006 Chrysler 300 for just $299 a month for 27 months, with $2128 due at signing. Tax, title, and license extra. Call 888-CHRYSLER for lease details. 20 cents per mile charge over 23,625 miles driven. Dealer participation required. Must take retail delivery from dealer stock by 8/31/06.
The Labor Day Sale at all Boyne Country Sports locations is going on now. And we're blowing out our 2005 and 06 skis, snowboards, and ski wear to make room for new winter merchandise arriving daily. Save up to 40 to 60% off on skis, boards, boots, and ski wear. Plus, 2005 and 06 spring and summer golf wear is 30 to 70% off. Poles, boots, bindings, helmets, goggles, luggage, and backpacks are up to 50% off. Hundreds of pairs of skis and boots from only $99. Used junior ski packages start at just $149. And sign up for Boyne Rewards today at BoyneRewards.com. And you can earn points on your purchases. Use your points for free lift tickets, greens fees, lodging, Avalanche Bay Indoor Water Park passes, Boyne Country Sports gift certificates, and much more. The Labor Day Sale at Boyne Country Sports is going on now through Monday, September 4th. And now is the best time to save on last season's equipment and winter wear. Boyne Country Sports in Bloomfield Hills, Novi, Traverse City, and Petoskey. Visit us at BoyneCountrySports.com.
To you, it's a soccer game. To them, it's an all-out smorgasbord on your ankles. And the moment you stand up to cheer for your kid, the backs of your knees are the next target for hungry mosquitoes, especially when you sweat. Don't let mosquitoes make you work this Labor Day. Off-Active Mosquito Repellent gives you proven protection, even when you sweat. So go ahead, watch those mosquitoes swarm under the lights. That's the closest they'll get to biting you. Get Off-Active and keep bugs off, even when you sweat. S.C. Johnson, a family company.
Hi, is Michael there?
This is?
Okay, my name is Neil.
Yeah.
And we've never actually met before, but I used to own your Volkswagen Jetta.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah. I just miss it, you know? And, how is it?
It's great. It's a great car.
Isn't it? It is so great. Let me ask you something. Is it dirty? Because I could wash it.
Feel the pre-love. Certified pre-loved Volkswagens featuring the 112-point inspection. Come take a joyride today.
Time is running out. Time is running out on the best deal ever. On your opportunity to make an investment that can change your life forever. Time is running out on your chance to register for Oakland Community College's fall 2006 semester. Register on the web at oaklandcc.edu or visit any of OCC's five convenient campuses to register for your choice of classes in literally hundreds of subjects. Classes like business, psychology, computer information systems, physics, English, pre-engineering, robotics, and more. If you want to take a giant step to a better life, Oakland Community College is your education answer. Call or visit your local OCC campus now. They're in Auburn Hills, Waterford, Farmington Hills, Royal Oak, and Southfield. Oakland Community College at oaklandcc.edu. Get anywhere from here.
Classes begin August 31st.
We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
All right, thank you very much. Has that alarm ringing always been in that sounder? I don't know. Give us a call, 313-298-WRIF, 313-298-9743. And at 1 a.m., we're going to be doing some interviews, including one with Dr. Jared Bernstein from the Economic Policy Institute. The reason I say it like that, I'm remembering all this. I don't have it written down. He's going to be talking about Katrina and the aftermath of it. Bush is trying to put the best spin on it imaginable, but Frank Rich in Sunday's New York Times says in a column called Return to the Scene of the Crime, he writes, President Bush travels to the Gulf Coast this week ostensibly to mark the first anniversary of Hurricane Katrina. Everyone knows his real mission, try to make us forget the first anniversary of the downfall of his presidency. And here's what he's going to do. The president is designating Tuesday, the Katrina anniversary, as a national day of remembrance. You wouldn't think he would want us to remember, but I guess it's going to be all over everywhere anyway. And so he probably is trying to just put the best spin on it possibly. Remember that, Brownie? You're doing a heck of a job talking to the head of FEMA. And he said, Brownie, you're doing a heck of a job. So you would think that the guy's nickname was Brownie. But I just read an interview with him, and that was the first time anyone ever called him Brownie. And Bush, when he's not farting, you know, you heard this earlier, that he farts for fun in front of, like, new interns. Well, that's kind of like close to sexual harassment. How would you like to walk into a room with the most powerful man in the world, and at some level, you must know he's a dope anyways, right? And suddenly he cuts loose, and everybody goes, you know, these rich frat rats, right? That's the kind of humor that they're involved in, which he was kind of noted for when he was snorting cocaine and stuff like that. Anyway, the National Day of Remembrance on Tuesday is going to honor those who lost their lives and property. Well, isn't that a nice way to do it? Look, here's Hezbollah, an authoritarian right-wing theocratic group, and what it's doing, it's like Israel stops fighting, the ceasefire happens, and poof, they're there like the next day with a construction company. They're giving all these families double their average income for Lebanon. I think they're giving them like 12 grand. They're doing everything imaginable. It's like the most of the people, particularly the poor in the Gulf region, would probably love it if Hezbollah came over and helped them. Bush is spending 2 days in the Gulf region next week to mark the anniversary. I wonder if the major media is going to roll over for him. What a joke, of course they are. He'll be in Mississippi on Monday to have lunch with community leaders, walk through a neighborhood, and deliver a speech on the rebuilding effort before traveling to New Orleans, where he is scheduled to have dinner with state and local officials and spend the night. On Tuesday, Bush is attending a service of prayer and remembrance, conducting a roundtable discussion on an effort headed by the First Lady Laura Bush to restock Gulf. Well, good. She should do that. He also will give a speech and visit with local residents. But let's see. Things are not going well here. Government fulfills few Katrina promises. And this was, is this the one from Corp Watch? In other words, Corporation Watch. Nearly half New Orleans was still underwater when President Bush, Bush stood on the Crescent City's historic Jackson Square and swore he would do what it takes to rebuild the communities and lives that had been laid to waste 2 weeks before by Hurricane Katrina. That was in Jackson Square, and if you remember that, this was staged by people from ABC Television. They had previously worked for it. There was no electricity in the whole region. They flew in all these generators to make it look very dramatic and very presidential. And so Bush said, and thank you, my fellow Americans. They turned off the lights and they were all gone. They flew back to Washington. Well, emergency assistance, a June report by the Government Accountability Office concluded that FEMA wasted. Remember, whenever you hear these figures, it's not like the government money, right? It's our money. So it should say taxpayer money. But FEMA wasted between $600 million and $1.4 billion on, quote, improper and potentially fraudulent individual assistance payments. So they weren't up on that. Cleanup. The job still isn't done. More than 100 million cubic yards of debris has been cleared away from the region. So far, the government has spent $3.6 billion, a figure that might have been considerably smaller had the contracts for debris removal been subject to competitive bidding. So they let all these contracts, it's like the, in fact, I think they're down there, Halliburton and what have you. So this is like a little Iraq that these big companies take all our money. And in fact, you'll hear some of this at 1 o'clock. Housing, goal was to get people out of the shelters by middle of October last, but a few thousand of the 270,000 Katrina evacuees are still not in homes. Rebuilding goes on and on. Levees, the federal government hasn't broken any promises with regard to flood protection, mostly because it has avoided making any, right? So they don't know what the hell is going on. Poverty. Bush offered 3 proposals in Jackson Square to help combat poverty around the Gulf Coast region. 2 of them never went anywhere. 3rd proposal goes on with that. One of the things, see, you got to remember, these guys got more going in their agenda than just helping people. And one of the things they want to do is remove the last blue state. In other words, the last Democratic state, because they got a Democratic governor. They got 2 Democratic senators, aren't I right? At least 1, maybe 2. And they got a Democratic mayor of New Orleans. And what they want to do, they don't want people to return. They particularly don't want poor people, and they don't want African-American people to return. They don't want them as Democratic Party voters. So they're in no real hurry to make this, put this all back together. It's pretty cynical, isn't it? But that's the way things go. All right. You can give us a call on that or anything else. What are you expecting when we enter into this period? It's going to be too nausea, as my sister says, too nausea even to contemplate. But that's what we're going to be treated to. That's the news. By the way, there's all these grassroots groups down there that are doing incredible work that didn't wait for the government and that have some pretty interesting and serious critiques of what's going on. You won't hear from them. You'll hear all the stage-managed Republican attempts to fix the damage that happened to them. That's the Katrina damage that they're worried about, not the damage that happened to real people like you and me. So 313-298-WRIF, and let's see, we'll go to Darius. Darius is in Detroit. Hi, Darius, you're on the air.
Hi, Peter.
Hi.
Yes, you are so right talking about it. I before you was talking about military and the women who were getting abused and everything like that.
Sure, harassed, right, raped.
Harassed like that. I mean, would it make sense just to ask yourself a question, what are women doing in the military in the first place? Any respectable army, like a Russian or Israeli or any other Western country army, they do not accept women into military. And
Wait. Don't they have... They have sure, they have
all
lots of women.
In Australia or Canada or, you know that's all the South countries, but all the, like, ex-communists, countries, we talked before, I'm from Poland, and it is unimaginable to have a woman in the army. It just doesn't, I could see women in a non-combatant situation, yes, administrative jobs and stuff.
Wait, I don't think women go directly into combat. I think
yes, in American Army, they are very close to being combatants.
Yeah, what was that woman?
Very close, yes.
Remember that raided when the U.S. first invaded, and that woman, the Pentagon made up this whole BS story about how she was captured in combat and all that. It turned out that the Iraqis actually...
They're being a truck drivers, which I was,
maybe that was it.
In the U.S. Army.
Yeah, there you were?
I was 2 years... I was in Germany for 2 years in 87, 86, to 88.
Did you get citizenship by doing that?
No. I was a green. I had a green card, which was a resident alien card.
Mm-hmm.
And it didn't help me in any ways.
It does now because there. I think something like 30,000. There's 30,000 foreign-born. U.S. troops in Iraq, and it's a way that puts them on a fast track towards citizenship.
At the time when I was serving, I guess there was no rush. There was no incentive. I guess there is an incentive right now to get immigrants into the army because obviously when you were talking about it, they don't have enough people to get into military.
Mm-hmm.
They even made the age. I'm thinking I'm 40 right now. They raised the age where you can go into military from 30, 33 or 35 up to 42. Now
there is actually a 42-year-old grandmother and her daughter that are serving together.
Yes, it is.
This is.
We spoke before. I was serving when the first during the Reagan years, and then I was in a reserve, and I was conscientious objector, and there was no way to fight the status quo, which was you have to go and that's it. You have nothing to say, and there was only like 14 people who actually got through with a conscientious objector status, and I think only half of them wound up.
Actually getting it? Well, wait a minute, Darius. Let's go back to one of your first contention. There are women in... There's a lot of women in the Israeli army, I think.
They're probably in non-combatant and status.
The same thing is true in the American army. They're not in forward combat positions.
Well, we just said about the girl that got caught in the crossfire, didn't we?
Yeah, but she was, I don't know. Didn't you say she was a truck driver? I can't remember what her deal was.
Well,
I can't even remember her name.
Don't you think it's close enough to
well, yeah,
to
sure.
call it
and there's been combat? there's been female U.S. casualties in the military.
we should not get them as close. You know, if they want to serve.
Yeah. Why? What? Why not?
Just keep them in the office.
Why not? Why shouldn't they?
Be a combatant.
Yeah.
It makes us look silly. Well, that's what I think. It makes us.
Well,
look
appearances.
Silly.
I mean, what we want to know: can they serve? Can they serve operationally effective? That's what I think the real question is. Well, I don't know. A lot of maybe you guys and women are vets. What do you think about what Darius says? Well, all right, Darius, thank you very much. Appreciate your call. Here is Gary. Gary's in Sterling Heights. Gary, hi. You're on the air.
Hey, dude. How you doing?
Doing great.
Good. Yeah, a couple questions for you. Someone tapped into what I was wanted to talk about was loose change. I actually saw another documentary by Alex Jones. Are you familiar with Alex Jones' work at all?
I am.
Okay. But he talked about what they're trying to do with Schwarzenegger, how they're trying to make this where someone's born outside the United States can eventually run for president. And his ties to Bush Co. and the Hitler connection, this and that. What are we looking at if they get something like that to go through?
That means we could have Jennifer Granholm be the a president because she's from Canada.
Yeah. So, well, I don't know. What I'm thinking is, now 35 years old, I have two sons who probably someday down the road line up in the draft if they, you know, this world's going to be crazy forever.
Yeah.
What can we do? I have friends of mine who are in the Marines. They feel the same way I do. But we're losing control of all of our rights and our powers, and it seems like there's becoming a separation between, like, the elite and the middle class. It almost seems like there should be a third party involved.
Well, yeah, that might be a good idea. I mean, what really first, I understand where you're going, Gary, and I support you 100%. What's happened before in American history whenever there's been powerful third-party movements? And none of them have been very successful, but they're usually been based on widespread social movements of protest, sometimes based around the unions, like in the 1880s, and a call for it, like in the 1930s and 1940s. But unfortunately, this is like a Latin American country where the two big well-financed parties, financed mostly by corporations and the wealthy, and one is usually very conservative and one is liberal, but they still mostly carry out the policies of the corporations that dominate the country's economy. And are we ever going to get representation that carries out the needs of the people, those of us that are in the middle class and the working class and the poor? I don't know. Sometimes I'm not real hopeful about it, unfortunately. But we keep on. All right. Thank you very much. Appreciate your call. Let's see. This is from Robert. He writes into calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Hey, Pete, you have to be the hardest working guy in radio. Does he know me? He does not know me if he says this. But he says, man, you were all over the dial this week. AM and FM, morning and night, keep up the good work. By the way, like to hear your views on illegal immigration issues. Specifically, what do you think we should do with the 12 million illegals already here? Well, yeah, I've been substituting on the Air America Radio Network. If you go to my website, you can see the details on that. PeterWerbe.com, W-E-R-B-E.com. What do I think we should do with the 12 million illegals already here? I don't know. What can we do with them? They're here. I mean, beats me. One of the things we ought to do is understand what drives people here from Mexico and other Central American communities particularly. But there's also illegals here from Ireland, from Poland, lots of other places that have been hard hit economically in Europe. But the majority of them, the vast majority of them are from Mexico and Central America. And as long as we have, like here, we talk about the rich getting richer, which they certainly are, and the poor getting poorer, and the middle class stagnating or losing ground, well, that's the same relationship between this country and the countries south of us. And what we have are the people that are extraordinarily enterprising, that really care about their families, that are willing to go to extraordinary efforts to get here where the money is. So if we could create a regional-wide, unionization movement, and so Ford doesn't pay people $2 a day, or $2, I guess they're up to $2 an hour now, that's the highest wages. And below that, people are working for, if they have jobs, if they're their family and community farms, some of them which go back hundreds of years, haven't been ruined because of NAFTA, and they're driven into Mexico City where there's 20, 25 million people who nobody knows even for sure. And the ones, as I say, the ones that have the spirit that normally we would admire say, I'm going north. I'm going to go, I no longer have the farm that my ancestors have, and I'm not going to live on a garbage dump, literally. Like, couple million people do at least in Mexico City, and I'm going to go north and lay bricks or hang drywall or work in a convenience store, something like that. So what do we do with the 12 million that are here? I have no idea. I have absolutely no idea. This is a problem that's longstanding and deeply rooted in the distribution of wealth throughout this hemisphere and the world. As long as you have haves and have-nots, you're going to run into situations like this. And putting up big walls or rounding them all up or making laws against day workers congregating on a street corner ain't going to happen. It's not going to fix anything. 313-298-WRIF, and here is someone else in Sterling Heights. I don't have your name. Hi, you're on the air, though. Who's this? Hello, hello, hello.
Hello?
Yeah, who's this?
Hey, it's Paul.
Paul, hi, you're on the air. Welcome.
Welcome. Hey, I was on my way home. I heard your, I'm not calling about, military reasons. It's just...
Whatever.
I heard your talk about, what's going on with Michigan, and I really think that, it's...
Good? Bad?
Bad.
Okay.
The way things are going,
Too bad even to really sometimes find the words for, huh?
Yeah, it is. I started typing you an email, and I, scratched it, and,
Well, let me do this for you. I don't remember you calling before, so what I would suggest, and I would suggest to many of you, is scratch down some notes. I've learned over the years when sometimes I'm thinking, I don't know what I'm going to say next. Well, I'm a professional broadcaster, so you'll learn how to do it. But if you're kind of new to it, it's difficult a little. So best thing, if you want to email me, calltalkyes@yahoo.com, or, as I say, some notes often help get on the air with it. All right, Paul, thank you very much. By the way, people are looking to this election coming up between the incumbent governor, Jennifer Granholm, and this ultra-right winger, Dick DeVos, who's the Republican gubernatorial candidate. And he selected, I think you might know, the Oakland County clerk as his choice for lieutenant governor. So what do you say? It's kind of based on the fact that she's a woman, that she's in the most populous county and all that. But there's a lot more to it as well. Ruth Johnson, she also runs the voting in Oakland County, and she supervises the counting of the votes. So you can say, come on, Pete, what are you doing? Is this Ruth Johnson? She's not an honorable person. Well, Catherine Harris was the Secretary of State in Florida in 2000. She was the head of the Bush campaign, responsible for who could vote and who couldn't, and also for counting the votes. We saw what happened in Florida. In 2004, Kenneth Blackwell was the Secretary of State, the head of the Bush campaign in Ohio, and was responsible for supervising the voting and counting the votes. And I hope most of you know what happened there as well. People were prohibited from voting. There's a lot of suspicion about how they were counted. So I would think that it'd be appropriate for Ruth Johnson to resign as the Oakland County clerk just to rise above any even appearance of impropriety. Hey? All right, let's go back to our phones. And here's Al in Inkster. Al, hi, it's Peter Werby. You're on the air.
Hi, Peter. How are you?
Doing good. Thanks.
That caller before that was talking about women not being in the military.
Or shouldn't be. And Darius said the women shouldn't be in the military. It makes us look bad. Makes us look weak.
She's got a history because the Russians used women as combat troops throughout the entire World War II.
Yeah, actually, you're right. You're right.
The sex columnist, Dr. Ruth, you know what she did?
I give up.
She was a sniper with the Israeli army that had confirmed kills in one of the wars.
Dr. Ruth?
Dr. Ruth! Dr. Ruth,
saw you using protection last time out here.
Is she still around? Does she still do her sex advice show?
Yeah, I think she's in the local paper, if you can read it in the 5 minutes it takes.
Wow, damn. Now, you got to spend a lot of time reading all the ads.
Yeah, he's not a student of history because, I mean, women served with the Russian Army, the Russian Air Force, the Russian Navy, all in combat.
Yeah, and I know they serve in the Israeli Army.
Dr. Ruth,
there's the proof. All right, thanks a lot, Al. I appreciate it. Here's Ryan in Milford. Ryan, hi, you're on the air.
Hey, how's it going?
Going great.
I was just calling about the all about Michigan. I don't really think it's going anywhere right now.
Well, with what's happening in the auto industry, with all the geniuses running the big three, particularly the big two, are they even the big two anymore? Plants and I got an idea. Let's make Hummers and huge pickup trucks and big SUVs. That'll work. Well, it did for a few years.
Oh, yeah, good for what? Good for gas? Anybody's just trying to suck gas out of Michigan here, and I think it's Michigan's just current, like the whole United States is turning a bit, bunch of chaos.
Yeah, well.
I think it's doing much, this war is not doing much of anything.
No, well, it is taking all of our money, our tax money, and funneling it to these corporations, Bush's buddies, but it's not doing much for our state, is it? I mean, just think about it. They could take the, I mean, what does it cost now? It depends on how you figure it. The low ball figure is like $300 billion. And I was just reading this thing earlier about how the whole infrastructure of the United States received what? A D. The American Society of Civil Engineers last year graded the nation D for its all over, its overall infrastructure condition. And that's where this money should be going. And that's the kind of, think of the kind of jobs that would create in almost every field. And you say, well, I mean, Halliburton hires people. The Carlyle Group hires people. Raytheon hires people. But it's capital intensive and technologically intensive. So, sure, there are workers and even union workers producing munitions and planes and stuff like that. But mostly it's, you know, these huge amounts of money that go to make the armaments that that just don't have the kind of buck or bang for the buck, if you will, that that like road projects and schools and whatever else we need to make our country not get a D in infrastructure condition, right?
Yeah, totally. I totally agree with that. And what's going on with the war in Iraq? And I wasn't calling in just because of the. I was like, I don't know anybody in the military, but the only thing I'm saying is that this just war, man, it's just creating a bunch of chaos. And the oil fields and all this stuff that's going on in the U.S. And you know what? It just really isn't worth it, man. It's just...
Yeah, well, I don't know what it's going to take to put us right. There's... and people are... I was just looking. In fact, this film, I was just... previewing this film that's going to come out called Jesus Camp. And what's happened in the United States when there's been these periods where the country appears to lose its way, there gets to be these huge religious revival where people expecting the return of Jesus and because the life on earth doesn't seem to have the qualities that make any sense to people, just like you're saying, or where are we going? I mean, it used to be the country was always improving and there was progress and the middle class was expanding and the working class was earning more and more money. Now it's being reversed. So instead we have war and terror and this feeling that you can't trust any politician. And I wouldn't say it's feeling. I would say it's true. All right. Thank you very much. I appreciate it. In fact, I think what we're going to do, and I don't have a mouse in my pocket in this regard, is that I don't want to say where it's going to be shown, but we're going to have a showing of this film, Jesus Camp, and we're going to invite you, the listener, and anyone else who wants to come, and then we're going to have a panel discussion. And as it stands now, the two moderators would be me, the resident atheist, and a publicist whose brainchild this was, who was a mass-going Catholic. So that ought to be interesting. But I'll tell you about it as this develops, probably next month or something like that. Also, remember, I would say I'm not doing the show next week, that I'll have it off for Labor Day, right? All right, so let's see. Let's go to George, who is in Canton. George, hey, it's Peter Werby. You're on the air.
Hey, how you doing?
Good.
Now, what can I talk about the military? I'm in the military. I'm a corpsman with the Navy.
Okay.
And there's a lot of guys I know that's been over in Iraq. And I've been over Iraq. And we have no problem going back over and doing what we do. At all.
Don't you think it's kind of all just going to hell?
Not really, because too much of the media nowadays shows too much negative than what's really going on over there. And about half the people, the three-quarters of the people, you'd be amazed. When you get the kids come out here saying thank you for what you do, it's amazing.
Well, I've had the opposite. People say that they thank them during the day, or they thank when. If I saw like we were at an invaded and occupied country by the Chinese army, and Chinese troops with guns were walking down my block in my Detroit
right.
suburb, I would and they gave me something. I'd probably smile at them and say thank you.
Yeah.
I mean, what the hell is somebody from Michigan doing in the middle of Iraq? What are our troops even doing there? What's the mission?
Well, for one thing, we got rid of a person that was really hated by the people.
Well, wait a minute.
Wait.
Bush is really hated by the people. Would you like the Chinese army to come over here and get rid of Bush?
No. But here's a big but. Bush, you can impeach.
Yeah.
But we're saying you can't.
Yeah, but wait a minute. There is something called, like, the UN Charter, which does not allow aggressive wars, that Iraq never did a single thing to us. They never had weapons of mass destruction. There wasn't. And by the way, Saddam Hussein was Bush's father's buddy and Reagan's buddy and Donald Rumsfeld's buddy. The reason he's in Iraq, the reason he was in Iraq, the reason he was so powerful is because of all those Republicans that saw him as this great ally. So all of a sudden, he became inconvenient. But that's not why we went to Iraq. We were sold this bill of goods that somehow he was connected with 9/11, which Bush just said that he wasn't, and that he had weapons of mass destruction, which he didn't. And anybody who really examined it knew that Bush was lying and Rumsfeld was lying and all the rest of them were lying.
When it comes to this policy, I'm in the military. I can't. I'll follow the commander in chief. He tells us this. We do it.
What? I'm sorry. You must be on a cell phone. You're breaking up.
Yeah, we are.
Yeah.
The answer was.
Well, all right. If you're just carrying out policy, which I think is what you said, that has some dangerous precedents, too. And if you're being, you know, one of the things that goes on is particularly if you're in the military, since it's not like a democratic organization, you just have to follow orders. You have no real idea what the people at the top are planning because believe it, they're planning. Who knows what, whether they're going to get out immediately or they're going to be in there for however you know, long they feel like it, before elections, after elections, and your lives are at stake, and the lives of other people who you come in contact with. So, I mean, I understand this is a serious business. All right, but here, I want to read something. I want you to listen off the air. Thank you very much. A chief, this is, let me see, this was at commondreams.org, commondreams.org. A chief prosecutor of Nazi war crimes of Nuremberg has said George W. Bush should be tried for war crimes along with Saddam Hussein. Benjamin Ferenczi, who secured convictions for 22 Nazi officers for their work in orchestrating the death squads that killed more than a million people, said that both Bush and Saddam should be tried for starting, quote, aggressive wars, Saddam for his 1990 attack on Kuwait and Bush for his 2003 invasion of Iraq. So here is the Nuremberg prosecutor that is equating the dictator of Iraq, who carried out an aggressive war against Kuwait, with George W. Bush, who did essentially the same thing, who knew there were no weapons of mass destruction, who knew that Saddam Hussein had nothing to do with 9/11, but was waiting for the opportunity to be able to invade the country, occupy it, set up the world's largest embassy. You do know that, don't you, that the embassy in Iraq and Baghdad is being built where they can't build anything else. So our tax dollars, hundreds of millions of dollars, are being wasted and stolen, yet this billion-dollar, you heard me right, billion-dollar embassy, the largest in the world of the United States or any other country, is being built by foreign labor. There are no Iraqis working on this, and they're also preparing permanent bases. That is what this was, one of the things was all about, oil, protection of oil flow, and what have you. All right, we'll be right back. 313-298-WRIF, 313-298-9743.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with more of your calls right after this.
It's all good in the hood, baby.
The Rip Rock Girl World Tour continues.
Show me.
Find out when Rip Rock Girl Lisa will be hitting your town. Log on today at WRIF.com.
You'll get your own girl one day.
From 101 WRIF. Everything rocks.
Tired of shopping for clothes from companies that use sweatshop labor to produce them? Well, check out the Waking Up store at the Universal Mall in Warren. Waking Up stocks sweatshop-free clothing for men and women and carries U.S.-made and union-made jeans and shirts. Yes, real American-made blue jeans. They also carry clothes made from eco-fabrics such as organic cotton and hemp. They require no pesticides or insecticides to grow, and hemp resists mildew and bacteria and is more durable and breathable than cotton. All of Waking Up's eco-fiber vendors are Co-op America approved, which means they've gone through Co-op America's screening process and are clean, green, and sweatshop free. Waking Up carries free trade coffee, chocolate, and accessories. They also have a media section with books and magazines and a community bulletin board. So check out Waking Up at the Universal Mall in Warren on 12 Mile in DeQuinder, or visit their website at WakingUpStore.com. They're waking up. Are you?
Now, Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
Whoa, that was a little quick break. Had to do some shuffling here. And let me see. Okay, yeah. This is from Nicholas. He wrote into calltalkyes@yahoo.com. And he said, this is an email from a friend of a friend who is stationed in Kandahar. That's in Afghanistan, right. He is a member of the Canadian Army. You don't have to read this on the air, but I think this is a reasonable, well-written, and cynical portrayal of the war in Afghanistan from the Canadian perspective. Oh, I see. This is very long. Oh, I was just looking at his. I'm a freelance journalist, and I was blown away that one of the best of my peers is now risking his life for the glorification of Mr. Harper. Now, who's Mr. Harper? Who's Stephen Harper? The Prime Minister of Canada. Y'all knew that, right? He is a Bush clone. And how in the hell he got to be the head of Canada? Well, the Liberal Party was so lame. He says, oh, yeah, Mr. Harper and his neoconservative swinery that duped the rubes of our country into voting for him. Well, he didn't get anywhere near a majority of votes, and he probably won't be too long-lasting as the prime minister. I know this is long, but please give it a read. All right. Sorry, Nicholas. I was starting to read it. All of a sudden, it's back to the show. That ties in, and I've said this before on the broadcast. Canadian doctors elect advocate of larger private role in medicine. A doctor who operates at Canada's largest private hospital in violation of Canadian law has been elected to become the president of the Canadian Medical Association. The new president-elect, Dr. Brian Day, openly runs an illegal private hospital in Vancouver. And it goes on, opposition to private health care has diminished in Canada, in part because waiting times have more than doubled for certain procedures during the last 13 years. According to a conservative research group, and they talk about a debate. Private health clinics are opening at an average rate of one a week in Canada. Since its formation in the 1960s, Canada's publicly financed health insurance system has been at the core of the national identity. But also, and as I've said this any number of times before, that the United States is the only country in the world that, of the industrialized country, that not only does not have a publicly financed health care program, but can't afford one. I thought we were the richest country in the world. I thought we were number one. We can't afford one. First off, there never has been the public will because, as said, to use Nicholas's words, the swine that run this system have convinced us that it would be something horrible about having a national health program, which would mean that everybody would get health care. Well, now, since Bush has frittered away the family's fortune on gambling and other stuff like that, we couldn't afford it if we wanted it. But I will pose to Canadians the same thing that I frequently have. You have your choice. an armed forces, essentially, because you got Army and Marines and Navy and Commandos and all that, and taking part as a U.S. junior partner in these wars overseas, or your health care. You can't have both, because there's not enough money in Canada. And Prime Minister Harper of Canada wants to expand the armed forces. Why? Because these right-wingers are psychos, essentially. Why would he want to do that? Canada does not need an army. You may have heard me say this before. There's only one country in the world that will invade Canada, and I'm speaking from it right now about 8 miles from you up the road in the U.S. And obviously the Canadian Army could not stand up to the U.S. Army. So, and we have, please believe it, invasion and occupation contingency plans of your country. So why not just disband the army, have a small sort of police force the way they do in Costa Rica? And people always say, well, we're peacekeepers sometimes. Well, I have a peacekeeping force, but you don't have to have this huge Navy and this big Air Force. Get rid of the Air Force. Put the money into your health care. What the hell? What would you rather have? Your people fighting in this foolish war in Afghanistan that has turned out to be as insane as the one in Iraq, or a healthcare system? Well, you better believe what I would like. All right, let's go back to our phones. It is Paul from Dearborn. Paul, hi, it's Peter Werby on WRIF. You're on the air.
Hi, Peter.
Hi.
By the way, I did read various pieces about that, and I'll get to my topic in a quick moment.
About what? What I was just talking about?
No, the Nuremberg prosecutor.
Oh, yeah.
He's been at it for, 48 years. So I'd like to see Bush and Cheney and Wolfowitz and that whole crowd attempt to slander him by referring to him as a liberal.
Well, I thought you were going to say what I say. I'd like to see the whole bunch of them frog marched in handcuffs out of the White House and brought over to the world court. Of course, Bush made sure that the International Criminal Court has no jurisdiction over the United States. So every other country, like people in these ex-dictators and people in Rwanda and Bosnia and what have you, they can be taken to The Hague. But the United States has withdrawn its signature from the World Court Treaty and has actually passed a law that said that the United States can use armed force to invade the Netherlands if there's any United States citizen on trial in the World Court. We're talking rogue nation here, but go ahead.
Well, another coalition of the willing kind of a thing.
Yeah, well, this one was the coalition of the billing.
Yes.
Yeah, we paid them a lot of money.
My topic is September 11th, 2006, the fifth year anniversary.
Yeah.
It's already begun. The corporate media and their public relations firm, sometimes called the Bush administration, is going to start inundating us with the standard story about what happened 5 years ago.
Right. Wait a minute. Well, isn't it the opposite, though, that the American media is the public relations arm of Bush Co.?
It depends on, who's signing the check.
There you go.
Okay. But I did a lot of research a couple of months ago, and I handed it over to a very competent media, reporter guy. And he followed up on it with the FBI. What I found out, Peter, was that in no FBI documents, and the coup de grace was that on the FBI most wanted terrorist list,
yeah,
Osama bin Laden is not associated in any of the paperwork or on their poster with September 11th, 2001. Did you know that?
Well, I've certainly heard that. In fact, Bill just wrote in to watch. He challenges me to watch this video, then tell me that Bush Co. and friends did not have something to do with bringing down the Twin Towers.
Well, where I go is very focused, Peter. In other words, everyone's telling me Osama bin Laden did 9/11.
Yeah.
But when I go to the FBI, the guys that do all the investigations, they tell me, quote, we have no hard evidence that Osama bin Laden is connected to the events of 9/11.
Well, he says he was.
Oh, on what? A video that you watched?
Well.
Uh-huh. You've never spoken with Osama bin Laden. You don't know of the authenticity, so let me go there. So we filed a Freedom of Information Act request with the FBI demanding that they give us all of the paperwork that authenticates any Osama bin Laden video where he claims he did 9/11. We got a reply last week. The FBI told us to go, quote-unquote, pound sand. They will not reply to the FOIA.
To the Freedom of Information Act request, yeah.
Won't do it. So let me give
you... What does this all tell us?
Well, yes. So, I mean, point one, we don't know what it all tells us, and, you know, I have my personal opinions. But if you're going to tell me Osama bin Laden's the guy that did 9/11, why haven't you even indicted him?
Yeah, well, that would be interesting. They do that with Mexican drug lords, don't they?
They'll do. I mean, think about it. I mean, if you're on videotape at the local 7-Eleven store stealing a pack of cigarettes, they use that video to put you in jail.
Yeah.
Here they claim they've got a video of the guy saying he did it, but we don't even indict him.
Wait a minute, Paul. Back up, though. You're saying that there is no video on which Osama bin Laden admits to doing it?
Nothing that's been authenticated.
Or been authenticated.
Huh. Now, don't you think the FBI ought to authenticate what they claim to be their number one terrorist, and when they associate him with the most heinous what they claim is the most heinous terrorist act in history?
Well, then, who done it?
That's another subject, Peter.
Yeah, it is. There's a new book out by Lee Hamilton, the co-chair of the commission in Kane, the ex-governor of New Jersey.
Yes.
That it doesn't go very deep, but even still, it says still so many questions unanswered. All right, I have to move along, Paul, but there's a lot here. If you've got more, email me at calltalkyes@yahoo.com. And, we should get Ken from Grand Rapids. You've been waiting a long time. Sorry, Ken, go ahead. You're on the air. Thanks for listening from so far away.
Oh, that's okay, Peter. Actually, I'm out of your listening area, so I'm listening over the phone and enjoying it. I'm a first-time listener, and my first question is, I'm in the Grand Rapids area, and I heard the beginning of your show, and I think that you said that you were syndicated. I was wondering if there's anywhere I can pick you up on the west side of the state.
Well, why don't you do this for me? There's some problems working for a lot of people. If you go to my website, Peter Werbe, my last name is spelled W-E-R-B-E, PeterWerbe.com. It'll give you all the information.
Oh, okay, great.
Also, that this show is podcasted. It's repeated twice on the Internet, tomorrow on RadioPower.org. It's archived at WhiteRoseSociety.org. And so all that is on the website.
Okay. And every Sunday night is when your show airs?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. And I just got one thing. I don't want to sidetrack your show because you're in a different area there. But I heard you talking a little bit about the upcoming election for the governorship there.
Sure.
And on the west side of the state, you know, we know quite a bit about the candidate there.
Sure, Dick DeVos.
Sure, and we're kind of on to what he's got going on over here. And there's not a lot of support for him in the community.
Really?
Now, what I've heard about the east side of the state is that, you know, the economy being down, the economy being blamed on Granholm, even though, you know, it largely has nothing to do with her and she's doing a lot to turn it around, is that he's got a lot of support on the east side for that. And I was just wondering if, you know, what the climate is and if you've got your finger on the pulse of that and you could let me know what's happening on the east side.
Well, I'd say I don't know if I do have my pulse on it. It's the polls, of course, showed it about even right now. And I think when DeVos is, when people begin to pay these next couple of months more attention to it and they realize that Dick DeVos, who doesn't even put Republican on his campaign stuff, is a far-right winger and what kind of social forces he represents. I wonder, does he own a suit jacket? Every ad I see, he's always in his shirt sleeves, you know, showing the, you know, anytime I see a politician take their jacket off, I know it's going to be some BS.
Yeah.
So, no, it's hard to say. I mean, it's like always, how many people are going to come out to vote? How motivated are they? I mean, I've heard people that should know better that say, gee, you know, we just need a change. The economy's going to hell. The economy's going to hell because the auto industry is going to hell. It's nothing to do with Granholm. I mean, it's not to say she's not without criticism, but putting this would be back to the days of I'm so glad I forgot the man's name that was the governor. What's the kind of round guy that was the governor before Granholm?
Oh yeah, with the triplets.
The triplets, yeah.
That guy, yeah. 12 years.
Engler. Engler. Yeah, John Engler. Yeah. So it would be back to those days, which would be pretty bad. All right, Ken, I'm going to run along. So thanks for having joined us. You can check me out at my website, and thanks for finding us.
Thank you.
I appreciate it.
All right, we're going to take some calls quickly here, and let's see. I'm just doing it by time now. It's Jeff in Detroit. Jeff, hi. It's Peter Werby.
Hello. I just wanted to ask you a question about, let me get to that, Michael Moore.
Michael Moore, all right. Yeah, go ahead.
Does he have political aspirations?
Not as far as I know. Why? Well, why do you ask?
Well, I'm just curious because, you know, I think a lot of the people feel a disconnect, you know, with a lot of the politicians because, you know, they're from Yale and Harvard and all that.
Yeah.
And I feel that's the reason why they don't get elected or, you know, or don't get enough votes, you know.
Well, yeah, you're right. I mean, like Bush was from Yale, and he didn't get enough votes in 2000. I mean, he lost the popular vote, and he still became president. Now, Michael Moore is working on his new film called Sicko about the American health system, and all the health companies, all the HMOs and all of the pharmaceutical companies have ordered their employees not to talk to Michael Moore.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah.
They don't want to deal with him.
Hey, let me tell you, too, I don't know if you use the Internet, but his website, I don't go to it as much as I would like to, but it's michaelmoore.com, and he's got great stuff, great links, and I usually has an update on how his new film is going.
And John Kerry, they smeared him because of the Vietnam thing.
What?
John Kerry, they smeared him.
Oh, Kerry, yeah. Well, can you imagine that? Well, that's typical of them. The whole Bush administration is made up of what we call chicken hawks, guys that were old enough to serve in the Vietnam War, although managed to scam out because they were rich kids. Or Cheney's the best. He said, I had other things to do, like rather than you know, participate in this war in which you could kill or be killed. So all of them are. In fact, if you Google chicken hawks as one word and then see the list of Republican essentially draft dodgers, it's an astounding number. I mean, it's all of them. It's almost all of them, except for maybe John McCain. All right, thank you very much. Appreciate it. Let's go to, is it Travis in Fowlerville?
Yeah.
Hi.
It's Travis.
Yeah, go ahead, Travis. You're on the air. Are you a petroleum transfer agent?
No, I am not. Actually, what I was calling for was I was over in Iraq for two tours over there.
Wow.
I was with an MP unit. I didn't necessarily agree with the war.
Yeah.
Quite a few friends over there that war, which was pretty much pointless.
Yeah.
But I did it because I love my country and I wanted to serve them. But to that corpsman that called and said that these people are thanking us over there, these people will thank us during the daytime, but at night we're arresting them because they're running around with AK-47s taking pop shots at American soldiers. So that country is not as thankful as everybody seems to think they are that we're over there. Half of them don't want us there. They will do anything they can to try and get us to think that we want them there.
Mm-hmm.
Want us there.
But you know, Travis, it was just the same in Vietnam. In fact, if you go to one of the first American interventions like that was after World War One, when these American troops from the Detroit area, mostly made up of Polish immigrants, in something called a Polar Bear unit, were sent to northern Russia, to Archangel and Vladivostok, and they said the exact same things. They said, they smile at us during the day. This is 1919 now. They smile at us during the day, and they shoot us at night.
And it's the truth.
Yeah.
That's everything that's going on over there right now.
Well, I'd like to get everybody home safely. I just now got two friends of mine, fairly young men, 18 years old, one in the Marines, one in the Army, are heading that way. And sort of the fright we feel is very common in areas where people have young people over there. All right, thank you very much. And it's not all, like I said earlier, it's not only young people. I look at the list of the dead, and it's people frequently, 36, 38. And I'm sorry, that grandmother, they just took her in, 42 years old. By the way, there is a monument to the Polar Bear unit and the people that died with the senseless intervention trying to stop the Russian Revolution after World War II. And if you go out to, what's the name of it? If you're going out towards DTE, to the concert venue, and if you look on the west side of I-75, and it says where memory lives in beauty, you ever see that big sign? And in there, I don't know if you can see it from the road, or I've just seen photos here, but there's a big polar bear statue, which is a memorial to the men that are buried in there from the polar bear regiment from great numbers of Detroiters. Speaking of Polish Americans from Hamtramck, it's Stella. Hi, Stella.
Hi, Pete. How you doing?
Doing great.
I just wanted to know if you learned anything about that new Medicare drug program. It's just the new way to screw the poor. You know, they knew the Social Security reform wouldn't fly.
Yeah.
So people that qualified for free drugs have to buy premiums, and then they go into what they call a donut hole. Of course, they pay hundreds and thousands of dollars out of their own pocket.
Yeah.
Poor people. I'm just so pissed. He's supposed to be a Christian.
Well, yeah, and a friend of the pharmaceutical companies. Yes. Who is another way for them to make even more money. I mean,
you know, just think how many people would still be alive if he wasn't reborn, you know?
Well, that's a good way to look at it. All right, Stella, thank you very much. Hi, this is Night Call, and you're on the air. Good evening.
Bullshit.
Well, we're going to get you rid of you. Okay. Hi, it's Night Call, and you're on the air.
Hello?
Hello.
Hey, this is Bill from Troy, Michigan.
Yeah, hey, Bill.
Hey, didn't listen to your show and totally want to elaborate on some of the subjects we got going on here tonight.
We got about a minute or two, so go ahead.
All right, well, this country's becoming such a melting pot, and I'm not a racist or nothing, but America's Constitution really doesn't even have any grounds anymore, you know?
Well, what does that have to do with the melting pot? You know what the melting pot is that the scum rises to the top and those on the bottom get burned.
Right.
Yeah.
But, like, what I'm saying is just, like, I mean, did Thomas Jefferson and, you know, all the guys that signed the original Constitution believe that America would turn out to be this way, so greedy almost?
I don't think so. Remember, they were illegal immigrants.
Really?
Yeah.
You know,
so, all of them. All of us.
Yeah.
In a way.
In a way, yeah.
Yeah. Well, not us. I guess we came. Our folks probably came here illegally.
Yeah. And I'm really, like, deciding whether I want to, you know, immigrate elsewhere. You know, I want to be the minority this time, you know, because, I mean, this country, we have to take care of everybody. A kid gets diarrhea in Indonesia, we have to donate money.
Well, man, you know, you're working off a real misconception. The vast majority of all foreign aid that we give, we don't give hardly anything to the scourge of youth diarrhea that does occur a lot in the third world. Most of it goes to the military. So when you look at your paycheck or your parents look at your paycheck and you see that money gone, besides paying debt service for the debt that Bush drove us into, part of it goes for billions and billions of dollars that we give to countries like Israel and Egypt and countries all over the world so that they can then buy back from us weapons of war and create carnage like we saw in Lebanon. So make sure that you know, you've got full information. All right, thank you very much. I got to end the show. Thanks for being our last caller. Stay tuned. Got a good interview on Katrina. And keep your head about you. And I'm sorry, I don't mean to be presumptuous, but you're going to the big attempt to fool you about Katrina is going to be going with a full court press. So don't just get baffled by all the lights and everything like that. So I would say that I'm not going to do the show next week because it is Labor Day, but check it out or check my website. So stay tuned for the interviews.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with more Night Call right after this.
Can I have a bedtime story, Mom?
Sure. Once upon a time, there was a cat called Puss in Boots. Huh. You know, Daddy needs some new boots, and Zappos.com has lots to choose from.
Is that in the story?
What? Oh, sorry. Let's try another one. There was an old lady who lived in a shoe. You know, I could use some new shoes for that party this weekend. If I order today at Zappos.com, I can get them in time.
Hello, Earth Mom.
Sorry. Where were we?
The shoe story.
Ah, yes, Cinderella. Well, the ugly stepsister tried the slipper on, but it didn't fit. See, that's what's great about Zappos.com. Say I bought your new school shoes and they didn't fit. I could send them back with free return shipping.
Mom, I think you need some sleep.
You don't have to be this obsessed with shoes to shop at Zappos.com, but you will find millions to choose from, superior customer service, and helpful online reviews. That's Zappos.com, the web's most popular shoe store.
A friendly reminder from the Riff. Say please and thank you.
Give me.
Excuse yourself at the dinner table and make sure you get plenty of corn. 101 WRIF is hooking you up with a family values tour. September 9th at DTE Energy Music Theater featuring Corn, Deftones, Stone Sour, and more.
The Riff got an end-of-summer concert blowout that can't be beat.
The Family Values Tour. You want the most tickets, the backstage passes, the interviews with the bands? Then where else you gonna get them? Except from your concert station in the Motor City. 101 WRIF. Everything that rocks.
We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. As most people know, it's been about a year since Hurricane Katrina hit the Gulf Coast and all the damage it's done. And there's been a lot of controversy about reconstruction and what's the future for New Orleans and the Gulf Coast. Joining me to discuss this is Dr. Jared Bernstein. He's senior economist at the Economic Policy Institute in Washington, also author of All Together Now, Common Sense for a Fair Economy. Jared Bernstein, thanks for joining me on the Peter Werby Show.
My pleasure.
Well, you may have seen there just a few hours ago, there was a press conference, and President Bush said that he wants people to remember that a one-year anniversary is just that. But there's a lot more beyond that. The government's saying it's doing quite well, that the Gulf Coast coordinator Don Powell says $44 billion has been spent to get the still battered region back on its feet, and they can expect another $110 billion. That $17 billion is going to help rebuild an estimated 104,000 homes, yet the residents aren't quite as happy. What can you give us your estimate of it all?
Well, look, I mean, President Bush and especially some of the agencies that oversee this, and of course I'm thinking of FEMA, have a tremendous amount of explaining to do. And I think that, the idea that they would try to suggest that this hasn't been a debacle, from their perspective is pretty outrageous. I mean, first of all, I will, and we all should grant them, it's a tremendously challenging problem. But, not only was, of course, the response at every level, not just the federal level, wholly inadequate to the challenge, but after the magnitude of the destruction was clear, they've been very slow in terms of getting help to the region. Only now do we find significant money flowing to folks who want to rebuild their homes. A very small minority of homes have actually been reconstructed or even begun to be fixed. I saw one poll result, something about, less than 20% of the folks down there felt that their life had much of a chance of getting back to normal soon. I mean, you could keep going. There's been terrible stories of waste and fraud in FEMA's distribution of checks. Remember that scandal
sure.
a few weeks ago?
Sure.
So it's really been, I think, a portrayal of government at its worst. And what's been very, I think, notable to myself and many others, especially coming out of some of the themes I wrote about in my book, is that it's government at its worst in an area where we need government to be its best. It's easy these days to disparage the government, especially after the very kind of things we're talking about now with FEMA and the response to Katrina. But clearly you need a safety net. Clearly you need an effective disaster agency. And it wasn't that long ago that FEMA was precisely that. I mean, anyone who only has a short memory would say, oh, it's always been like that. But no, there were numerous natural disasters, the Northridge earthquake, various hurricanes, in the 1990s, and FEMA performed really exemplary in terms of addressing those challenges.
Yeah, the charge there, of course, is that under Bush, that this has become, FEMA has become a repository for cronies and...
That's right.
And you accept that? You think that's true?
Well, yeah. I mean, I've written about this. I mean, the first head of FEMA was Bush's college roommate, Joseph Albaugh. And, that's not necessarily a condemnation. It certainly smacks of cronyism. But, is this the best guy for the job? Certainly Michael Brown wasn't. But when Albaugh was given the job, He talked about the need to scale back FEMA, the importance of communities depending on private sector, like their churches and places like that, to help them through disasters. And obviously, churches and other institutions have a role to play. But I think the key factor you see here is this movement towards what I call you're on your own government. The idea being that we're going to scale back government to the point where its responsibilities are few, and you are on your own to fend for yourself out in the private market. Here's a tax cut. Here's an incentive. Here's a private account. You see this kind of political philosophy through so much of what folks in government espouse these days. And there are actually areas where that makes a lot of sense, but disaster preparation clearly isn't one of them.
Well, I was going to say that if we can go back a little further in time, maybe quite a bit now, Ronald Reagan's famous statement is the most frightening words you can hear is, I'm from the government and
right.
I'm here to help you, meaning that they, I won't say it quite like Lyndon Johnson used to, but he said they're bureaucrats that couldn't pour poop out of a boot if the instructions were on the heel. So the idea is, he said it a lot cruder, as you can imagine.
I never heard that, but I like that.
It's a good one.
Presumably, if you're looking at the heel, you're doing the job.
Yeah, you've turned it up. Yeah, that. But that that bureaucracy is inherently slow-moving, cumbersome, inadequate. But when something is of this scale, gee, you would think you'd have to.
Exactly. I mean, I accept everything you're saying, and the last thing I want to do is come on here and defend the federal government, especially given its current operations. But I absolutely do want to come on here and defend and elevate the role of the federal government in meeting the challenges, some of the challenges we face. Not all of them, because remember, need I remind anyone, this is a country found on individualistic values and the idea that folks on their own in a free market ought to be able to realize their potential. But the key factor that's gotten lost in this discussion is that individuals can't realize their potential if their houses are being blown away by Force 5 hurricanes. That's an extreme example, but they can't realize their potential if they don't have a safety net, if they don't have a health insurance system to support them, if they don't have a pension system to support them, and if they don't have an organized response to the challenges of globalization. And our government has to play a critical role in meeting these big challenges. It certainly doesn't have to get into your lives in micromanaging ways that are pernicious, but it absolutely has to use its scope, its ability to pool risk, its breadth to meet these global challenges.
Jared Bernstein, let's go to a few issues that may be somewhat below people's radar. Unfortunately, articles like I saw in Sunday's London Independent don't appear here. This one is entitled "Katrina Disaster Profiteers Pocket Millions in Deals," and it quotes Pratap Chatterjee, the director of CorpWatch. One year after the disaster, the slow-motion rebuilding of the region looks identical to what has happened in Afghanistan, in Iraq, and goes on to document the immense amount of fraud in many cases involving the same corporations. Are you as concerned as he is about this?
You know, I am as concerned. Now, I will say that I've only seen pretty much anecdotal evidence. And however, you know, the plural of anecdote is data. And at some point, we will probably see pretty convincing, I mean, if we actually have any oversight, which is a key piece of this puzzle, but I'm afraid what we'll learn when we actually get some oversight and some more detailed reports. I've read very convincing, but again, anecdotal reports of contractors that have not only failed to do the work, and absconded with the money, but ones who have done the work, but then failed to pay the employees, many of whom are folks who don't even have housing at this point. Some of them came into the area precisely to get on these construction projects, and there's been, from the accounts that I've been reading, there has been precisely this type of corruption.
Well, Chatterjee refers to the situations in Afghanistan and Iraq, which means, of course, on a much grander level, projects begun with millions of dollars of taxpayer money and never completed, whereas the firms that have contracted for them, as happened in Iraq, have still made a tremendous profit. That's what that obviously means by that phrase, disaster profiteers.
Yeah. Well, look, I mean, again, both in Iraq, Afghanistan, and certainly closer to home in New Orleans, there has been a conspicuous lack of oversight. And again, see, this is the problem with this, what I call this yo-yo framing, this you're-on-your-own approach to government. It's not that we necessarily have less government. In fact, Bush and company are spending as much the share of the economy on government as anyone else does. It's that you begin to chip away at some of the key government functions of which oversight is critical. You can funnel all the cash you want to your cronies if nobody's watching the teller window, and that's the problem. I think all of these agencies need oversight. But when you run for office on the basis of, you know, we're going to chip away at the government, we're going to bring you a leaner government, you know, that sounds very appealing, and for many of us it is appealing. What you have to, the hard questions you have to ask is, well, okay, what kind of government are you advertising here? One that spends $2.7 trillion a year, but we don't get our money's worth, which I think is a pretty fair assessment of what many of us are looking at. We don't have any oversight, et cetera. Or one in which we have the agencies in place to get their job done. I wrote an article recently called The Real Cut and Runners that people might want to look at, which suggests, you know, those folks who want to cut the budget yet run away from the consequences of those budget cuts are doing as much damage as anyone these days.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to steal that phrase, by the way. I may not even attribute it, but if you want to find out...
No royalties for me.
I should reintroduce you. Jared Bernstein is my guest, senior economist with the Economic Policy Institute. You can go to epi.org. That's where I get a lot of my economic information from. And he's also the author of a book published this year, All Together Now, Common Sense for a Fair Economy. Talk to us a little, if you would, about the effects on wages and one of these obscure little acts, at least to most people, the Davis-Bacon Act, and how this had an impact on wages in Reconstruction.
Sure. Oh, this was a fascinating little episode. Let me start with that piece. When right after Katrina hit, the Bush administration snapped into action and canceled the Davis-Bacon provision. Now, this is a pretty obscure piece of legislation, but it's actually an important one. What it says is that when the government comes into a local area to engage in construction, so the government initiates a construction project, they have to pay the prevailing wage to the workers on those sites. And the idea here is to avoid a behemoth, monopolistic kind of employer coming into a local labor market and setting the wage below what prevails. So you have to do that whenever a big employer comes into town. By the way, you've seen sort of ripples of this with the Walmart effect. You see Walmart coming into communities, and you end up with lower retail wages, and some communities, Chicago has an ordinance like this that they're arguing about, some communities will set a rule saying, okay, you're welcome to come in, but you have to pay a prevailing wage. It's just like Davis-Bacon. Well, the Bush administration said, look, we're just going to cancel these prevailing wage rules after Katrina. And it seemed to many of us to be just a total swipe at an already very vulnerable and damaged area. And thankfully, Congress put pressure on the administration, and they revoked that rule, and Davis-Bacon was back in place. The question about wages and incomes, I mean, if you're asking about the area in New Orleans, the Gulf Coast, not that much is known right now, although it does look like a pretty tight job market. That is, especially with the Reconstruction, there's a lot more work down there than you might have expected. The problem is that, much like we were just discussing, some of these seems to be some lawlessness going on, particularly among contractors who are failing to pay their workers. And I don't mean to indict good players. This is all anecdotes. I don't have a great deal of evidence, but the anecdotes suggest that while it's a pretty tight job market with pretty good jobs, especially in the rebuilding, people have had a hard time really getting back on their feet.
Well, you mentioned a little earlier about immigrant labor, and I don't know whether you actually said immigrant labor, but you mentioned about people not getting paid, and the immigrant labor was brought into the region to work for these construction companies doing the rebuilding, and there was a problem with them not getting paid, and that kind of brings in the whole issue of fear of American workers, particularly at the bottom of the wage scales, about it being replaced by immigrant labor. What's the situation there on the Gulf
Coast? Well, let's talk about that both in terms of the region, Katrina, but also more broadly. Yes, there was this. There did seem to be an issue by some of these large contractor firms to bring in immigrant labor to undercut the job market, and not only undercut it, but we've learned, as you said, and we both have said earlier, but to actually break the law by not paying some of these workers their wages that they were due. So obviously, there's some bad actors that were at play down there. The larger issue that I think listeners would probably be interested in is the impact of immigrant labor in the overall economy, and that's one that's been discussed a great deal in the immigration debate. And there's kind of two poles of the argument. One says, no, in fact, immigrant labor doesn't seem to have much of an impact on native workers' wages, on the earnings and employment opportunities of folks born here. And another end of the continuum says, oh, yes, it has a tremendous impact. I think I don't believe you can make the tremendous impact argument very broadly, but I do think that immigrant competition has put competitive pressure on the wages and the jobs, the incomes of the least advantaged native-born workers here, primarily high school dropouts, and I would say minority high school dropouts in particular. I will say that if you are a minority high school dropout, a young African-American person, for example, or an Hispanic person, even if you're native-born, your biggest problem is the fact that you're a high school dropout. Immigrant competition may exacerbate that problem, but I have been fairly supportive of welcoming immigration legislation in terms of dealing with that problem, although we can talk about that more if you want.
Well, we only have about 3 or 4 minutes left with you, Jared Bernstein, so we could talk about that. I remember at the time that the reporters suddenly were in at ground zero, and there was sounded like some decent reporting for once. And many of them said that this was going to open up the question of race and class. And yet it's pretty much been submerged. Certainly George Bush is going to be spending 2 days in the Gulf region, and they're going to have a prayer session. But he is going to talk about the rebuilding effort. Laura is going to be down there talking about restocking Gulf Coast libraries. But we don't have the discussion about race and class, particularly class, do we?
Well, look, we have the discussion for a couple of weeks after the storm hit a year ago. We're probably going to have it for another week, and we're going to have lots of folks like you and me saying, yeah, we don't have the discussion. And you're right, and I think the discussion tends to be pretty limited and pretty fluffy. It's a lot of rhetoric without much meat on it, and I think there's the issue. It gets back to what we were talking about earlier. If you really believe, and this administration, and it's not a Republican conspiracy, there are lots of Democrats who believe this too, if you really believe that you're on your own is the best way forward, so that the best you can do to someone is give them a tax cut and a private account, send them out into the market to flourish, then you don't have any tools in your toolkit to address issues of racial and class inequities, which are rampant, and they're obviously rampant. I mean, 5 minutes in front of a television a year ago would show you how rampant they are, and they haven't gotten any less rampant. The problem is we refuse to acknowledge that we need a new set of tools to address these issues, and if you have no tools except tax cuts for rich people or stuff like that, or private accounts for Social Security and health care, then what's the point of talking about it other than rhetorically? Bush gave a great speech in Jackson Square a year ago. There's no there there. And there's not going to be any there there until we initiate a new toolbox, which actually I think means a new set of leaders.
Well, there has been $44 billion already spent.
Well, that's a good point.
Yeah.
That's a good point. But again, and you raise a good point. I shouldn't be so caustic without acknowledging that there's been considerable billion. And that's something we can do. We can spend money, and it's not throw money, it's spend money. Again, with all the oversight caveats and, the waste and fraud and abuse kind of caveats we talked about earlier, one thing we can do is we can spend money on actual fixing damages. That doesn't address issues of race and class.
No.
That's a one-time fix of a national disaster. The issues of racial injustice, you know, you're not going to fix them with an infusion of cash into an area that's been battered by a hurricane. You're going to fix them with a set of rules, regulations, norms, a revitalized social contract that addresses the underlying factors.
And a higher minimum wage, for instance?
A higher minimum wage, a program that creates employment for the most disadvantaged workers, spending more, not less money on training them, making sure that those who have the inherent skills have a path to college, to secondary education. Because if you're poor, the likelihood that you're going to go to college, even if you're smart, is very low. A fiscal policy that doesn't simply hand, dollars hand over fist to the wealthiest, but actually make sure that that folks at the low end have the subsidies they need to make ends meet, even working at a low wage job. Those are the kind of ingredients I'm talking about. Housing is critical. You know, housing. Help in meeting high cost of housing, and not just in damaged areas, but throughout the country.
My final question for you, because I know you have to go. The political will does not seem there, certainly among the Republicans, for what you just suggested, nor, for that matter, among the Democrats. Are there any grassroots movements that are calling for the kind of renewal and the kind of fix that you mentioned?
I think there are, and I think grassroots is the right way to look at it. I think there are a number. I think maybe a little bit higher than the roots would be the union movement that's trying to revitalize itself, particularly under the Change to Win rubric, trying to organize workers in the service sector. Then if you look at the Netroots, a lot of those folks who are involved in, for example, the victory of Ned Lamont, folks who were cheering that in Connecticut, the Netroots are talking, I think, in many ways with this language. And then there are some of the actual community organization groups. ACORN looms large, since we've been talking about New Orleans. That's a big one. The Industrial Areas Union, that's another group that's kind of trying to do grassroots organizing. So I think there are some good folks afoot on this, on these matters.
Well, thank you so much for being with us. Jared Bernstein has been our guest. He's the author of All Together Now, Common Sense for a Fair Economy, and he's a senior economist with the Economic Policy Institute. There's a lot more at their website, epi.org. Jared Bernstein, thanks for being with me on the Peter Werbe Show.
My pleasure, Peter.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with another guest right after this.
Hi, I'm Mike Cox, Michigan's Attorney General, and I'd like to talk with you about drunk driving. Every drunk driving crash is 100% preventable. We can all play a part in preventing drunk driving by joining the nearly 150 million adults who have been or have used a designated driver. When you and your friends go out for the evening, choose a designated driver. And remember, always buckle up. Help keep Michigan's roads safe for everyone.
Divorce, custody, support. Three words that tell a man you have a serious problem. You can try to solve your problem by ignoring it, by calling some new lawyers who claim to suddenly be into men's rights, or by choosing a lawyer with a flip of a coin. Or you can tackle your problem with the experienced professionals at ADAM, the American Divorce Association for Men. You can call ADAM at 248-356-ADAM, and they'll answer your questions by phone at no charge. ADAM has been successfully representing white-collar professionals, business owners, doctors, blue-collar workers, and men just like you for over a decade. With ADAM, you get the advantages of a large law firm, but receive the attention and dedication of one experienced attorney who will handle your case from beginning to end. Because of its many years of experience, ADAM can design a strategy to help you protect your home, your property, your children, and your future. And remember, while others may claim to be the so-called new answer in men's rights, ADAM, through dedication, knowledge, and experience, keeps proving they're the right answer when it comes to protecting men in divorce. Call ADAM today at 248-356-ADAM. That's 248-356-ADAM.
When my son started having behavior problems, the total transformation techniques were like the instruction manual on how to deal with him. We got immediate results.
Ever wish your kid came with an instruction manual when he's disrespectful, defiant, or even abusive? Do you know how to fix it? I'm behavioral therapist James Lehman, and I'll show you how to change your child's behavior right now with the total transformation. The program that helps you fix every behavior problem under the sun. defiance, backtalking, lying, acting out in school, even problems with ADD and ADHD. There's no screaming, no fighting, no frustration. The Total Transformation is the program I've used for over 30 years to solve even the worst behavior problems. Your child will listen to you again, and you'll get peace and sanity back into your home. I guarantee it.
Call now and get How to Turn Your Child's Attitude Around in 1 minute or less free with your order. 1-800-325-2185. 1-800-325-2185. Call now. 1-800-325-2185. 1-800-325-2185.
The emergency room. Easily the biggest contradiction in the history of rooms. First off, it's not just a room, it's two rooms. The actual emergency room, where you go to get help, and the waiting room, where you're forced to sit for several hours before you're allowed into the emergency room. Shouldn't somebody put the urgency back into emergency? That's exactly what's happening at the Detroit Medical Center, the DMC, home of the 29-minute ER guarantee, where you'll see a doctor in 29 minutes or less, guaranteed. After all, it's called the emergency room, not the bad magazine, sit and wait, what the heck's going on back there? Is there even a doctor in the house room? That name would just be too long anyway. The DMC 29-minute ER guarantee. Is it a healthcare revolution? Maybe. We just think it's a better way to get better. See for yourself at Children's Hospital, Detroit Receiving, Huron Valley Sinai, Michigan Orthopedic, and Sinai Grace.
Now, Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. Peter Werby here with you. And you're listening to a rock and roll station, so do you expect to hear you expect to hear rock and roll, but what characterizes and distinguishes that form of music, very frequently it is the electric guitar. The electric guitar has been with us so long that even our grandparents will say, oh yeah, I listened to Charlie Christian, who used to play with Benny Goodman. So it's like the piano or the trumpet or something like that. And just like those instruments have histories, so does the electric guitar. Joining me is Andre Millard. He's Director of American Studies and a Professor of History at the University of Alabama at Birmingham. And he has edited a very, very interesting book. It's called The Electric Guitar, A History of an American Icon. So much so that the book is published in cooperation with the Smithsonian National Museum of American History and the Lemelson Center for the Study of Invention and Innovation. Boy, I'm out of breath, Andre Millard. Welcome.
Well, thanks for having me, Peter.
Thanks for being here. It's published, by the way, by John Hopkins Press. You would think, why would a prestigious university press, why would a distinguished professor of American studies and history be interested in the lowly American electric guitar?
Well, because it's so important. I mean, it's the most important instrument of the 20th century, will probably be the most important instrument of the 21st century. You can't really take the music out of American culture in the 20th century. And in terms of Johns Hopkins have a reputation for doing the most beautiful books about technology, you know, such as the railroad car. I mean, they make beautiful books where they treat the technology as an image, you know, as an artifact. And, you know, the guitar is such a, you know, beautiful artifact.
It is indeed. I mean, besides the sound that it makes, well, that's probably about 90% of the layman's appreciation, like mine. But then there is the object itself. But maybe we can do this, because it's pretty fascinating. Someone asked me, when did the electric guitar appear? I would say, you know, wasn't it the jazz guitarist Charlie Christian playing with Benny Goodman, but in the late 30s? But it goes back before that, doesn't it?
It does, but it was Charlie Christian who made the electric guitar, and that Gibson EH-150, you know, is a classic model guitar, and it has that really distinct sound. And I mean, it was Charlie Christian who took, in his own words, the guitarist from a robot just strumming to an artist, someone who was in the center. I mean, when you think about those Benny Goodman quartets and quintets, I mean, it's Charlie Christian's guitar that's the lead.
Mm-hmm. Well, tell people the previous role of the guitar. I don't think people...
Well, it had just been a basic rhythm instrument that was very soft, you know, in volume compared to the other instruments. And as bands grew bigger, in the 20s and 30s. I mean, it was being basically overshadowed by saxophone, trumpet, you know, that horn section that was developed. And it was just in the background, just strumming the rhythm.
Yeah.
That was it.
You can hear it sometimes on Count Basie when the band's a little quiet, and you can hear just his guitar. And what was it, Freddie Green? He had a famous rhythm guitarist. But yeah, up till then in jazz, it was accompaniment to other bass instruments like the stand-up bass and the tuba.
Well, the thing is, if you think just about Count Basie, I mean, whatever the guitarist, I mean, the bassist. I mean, you listen to the bass on Count Basie because, I mean, it's, I mean, that is the instrument to me that makes it. I mean, Count Basie, best rhythm section ever in my mind, and it's the drummer and the bassist that you listen to that both superstars in the world of jazz because they're louder and it's more an expressive, you know, more an expressive instrument. But once you start electrifying the guitar, you get all these tonal possibilities.
How did people react when they first heard an electrified guitar? It must have been fairly stunning reaction.
It wasn't in terms of jazz musicians. Certainly there was, you know, that it was accepted. You know, what was holding Charlie Christian back was his race, I think, more than his guitar.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, the wonderful story of his acceptance with Benny Goodman, you know, one of the most discriminating tastes in the world of music is a wonderful story. But, I mean, in terms of when the guitar started to upset people is when it got loud and when it got into the hands of women. And maybe when it got in the hands of African-American musicians and got into the mainstream of American popular music, that's when, you know, the sound was seen as a threatening sound. We have a little story in the book about a very little-known female guitarist from the 30s. And, you know, she says that they didn't like her playing loud. I mean, they, you know, her name was Cordell Jackson, and she says, no man could touch what I was doing, she says. And they tried to take a guitar away from her or make her play quietly. You know, it's the volume of the electric guitar that gets to people.
Well, and the instrument is still seen as kind of predominantly a male instrument. We're sort of amazed when women play the guitar in the same style as men. I mean, during the 80s, I can't remember who was this woman. She used to a very, very attractive woman, and she played essentially in her underwear. You know, she was. Do you remember? You don't remember who that is? Someone. All these listeners. They probably
made a big impression on you, Peter, didn't it?
Yeah, not her playing exactly. I don't remember that as well. But it was. It is unusual to play the guitar in your underwear. I would.
It certainly is.
Yeah.
It could have been, you know, Joan Jett.
Not Joan Jett.
One of those.
Yeah.
They were basically of Suzy Quatro. Basically, they were beautiful women trying to act like men in leather outfits or in their underwear. But nowadays, you know, the gender distinction in the electric guitar, which you're perfectly right. I mean, they've significantly shifted in the 5 or 6 years, you know, that this book's been in preparation. I mean, now, in the advertisements for electric guitars, you know, you often see young girls playing as much as young boys, you know. I mean, in terms of the wrappings on the cover and the promotional material. So
that's where marketing will lead culture.
Or it'd be an indication of culture.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, it's just a measure of, you know, they're not stupid, and I think, you know, they know who's buying their guitars, and they know who wants an electric guitar, and so now it's really no longer a boy's toy anymore. But 10 years ago, I mean, it's exactly, or maybe a little long. I mean, it's changed very, very rapidly, and now you see lots of bands with all female guitarists. And really, nobody raises an eye. But the thing is, they don't play in their underwear.
Yeah, that's good. That's an advancement as well. The book is The Electric Guitar, A History of an American Icon. And my guest on the Peter Werby Show is Andre Millard. He is the editor, has essays in there as well. And part of this book is about the technological development. So what did Charlie Christian do? Just take an old-fashioned guitar and slam a pickup on it?
No, he popularized Gibson's first big commercial attempt at having an electric guitar. And there were plenty of people who had put, pickups on acoustic guitars.
Mm-hmm.
And, and amplified it. I mean, it's not that big a deal to amplify, but actually having, the electrical pickup built into the guitar, and, it was sold with an amplifier, which I think was, less than 15 watts. He was the great guitarist, he was a star, and he really popularized that instrument. I mean, at those days, those were long ago, but I'm sure you remember them, Peter, when jazz really was popular music.
I've read about it in the history books. and also that Benny Goodman, an incredible musician, an innovator, and also willing to overcome social convention at the time by integrating his band, which, of course, was not real popular at that time as well.
Oh, I know. I mean, and you've got to remember, back then, integration was rare or non-existent, and it was a very courageous move on his part because the division between the races was pretty strong, and especially in the entertainment field too.
Mm-hmm. Now let's talk about some of these things that turn out to be innovations that are named after people. A lot of people have, I mean, I suppose with someone has a guitar and it's called a Les Paul, they understand that it's that's named after someone. Hopefully they know who it was. And things like the Fender, which I've had people think that, it's named after like the part of the car or something like that. Could you talk a little, as we get up into the 40s and into the 50s, what sort of technology was developed by these men and what kind of impact it had on the music?
Well, Fender and Les Paul, are kind of co-authors of the solid body electric guitar, which was, the next logical step from putting a pickup on an acoustic.
Mm-hmm. So there's no sound box.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Then you're working with a solid piece of wood. And both Les Paul and Leo Fender, remember, were heavily into electronics. They were both, they're known as guitar makers. But, Les Paul was the man who developed the multi-track recording system used in recording studios. Leo Fender was known for his amplifiers well before he made that first broadcaster guitar. So what they were doing was kind of working on a system. And, all the tonal possibilities that you can get out of a guitar, now you can go any route you want. You can change the amplification. You can work on that entire system to get a tone rather than just trying to alter the settings on the guitar itself or just the way you play, your left hand technique. So when they were freed from that hollow body, then they could, develop the electric guitar as a discrete instrument with its own, tonal palettes.
Mm-hmm. You have these incredible photographs in your book, The Electric Guitar, as well. One of them is Les Paul, who I believe is still with us and still playing, isn't he?
He's still with us. He's still playing.
Yeah.
He plays the same place once a week in New York City.
That's right.
I understand he's in fine health, and, if any of your listeners really want an experience, go and listen to him play, and then he just hangs out with the audience.
Yeah. And he's what, probably in his late 80s?
I bet he's even older than that.
Really?
I wouldn't surprise me. And, but he still plays, and he's still, along with, people like Chuck Berry in his 70s.
Hmm. Now, the photograph in your book shows he cut an acoustic guitar in half and put a solid strip he called the log.
Yep.
Explain that a little.
There's all this different. I mean, the competition for who invented the solid body guitar is intense. And, it's so important to the companies who are still competing and doing business that, they'll sue one another if one of them claims, to be the historical precedent for the guitar. So it's a very sensitive and highly controversial. But Les Paul's version of events is that he actually strung a pickup, which is really the important part, on that piece of wood, and then I think he was playing an Epiphone, and he took, the two sides of the Epiphone, the hollow sides, and just glued it, I think, to that solid piece of wood. The important thing is that, the amplification system could work with a block of wood. You didn't need, and as you say, you didn't need so much. People have put that pickup in bits of plastic and probably bits of cement or something like that. And that was a very important innovation. But as Les Paul says, no manufacturer was interested.
Hmm. Also, talk a little about the shape. The people have made the obvious observation that the guitar, the classic guitar, the classical guitar, has the shape of a woman. And yet, did you ever notice it?
Well, there's a lot of people that.
Maybe I should talk to a therapist. Never mind.
This
is the second time I've brought up women's bodies. Maybe I have a problem here.
I was thinking, you know, is it going to turn out to be like the Howard Stern?
All right. I'm blushing a little, but let's get to the shape. But all of a sudden, the traditional shape of the guitar at the top on both the top and the bottom of it are sculpted out, and yet if the eye can form the shape of the traditional guitar, what's that all about?
Well, because it's an instrument like a violin, which also has the shape of a woman, and there has to be constructed primarily in view of its properties as an echo chamber, as an amplification.
Mm-hmm.
Right? That's why you bend and shape that wood the way you do, and that's where the craftsmanship of the luthier comes in. You move to electric pickups, it doesn't matter what you put it on. I mean, that was the thing. It liberated guitar makers from one shape. They can make any shape they want. They could make any bass they want. I mean, the wood is still important to the sound of the guitar, but the world was now their oyster. And if you just look at colors, you know, I mean, guitars came in violin finish.
Right.
Sunburst violin finish. Not anymore. When Fender and Les Paul out, you could get them gold. You can get them white, which is very, very popular. You get them red. And back to your comment about, you know, Fender being thought of as part of the automotive industry. They're based in California, and there's a lot of companies around them that made paint for automobiles.
Hmm.
They got a lot of their ideas for the paint finish for the electric guitar from, you know, those sparkle finishes and other glossy finishes developed by, you know, chemical companies that we won't name on the air.
Okay, I was just looking because you have in your book The Electric Guitar that you edit. You have at least four essays, and just tell us about this one: Playing with Power, Technology, Modernity, and the Electric Guitar. We usually, like I said at the beginning, we take that sound for granted. But once one starts looking under the surface of anything, more appears. What's in here that you're looking at?
Well, the technology idea is the guitar as an example or a harbinger of modernity, of new technology. You know, it's developed. The solid body guitars start running, coming off the lines, you know, early 50s, 52, 54. At that point in time, you know, we're right after World War II. The United States is thinking of itself as the high-tech leader. And especially space travel,
mm-hmm.
Shape of the guitars, many of those guitars, reflect space aerodynamic design, such as the Gibson Flying V.
I was just looking at that, yeah.
And the electrical guitar manufacturers, you know, position themselves as, you know, purveyors of very high technology and selling a very modern product. You know, they embrace, you know, as I write in the book, the American people were embracing space travel from, you know, NASA to the Jetsons.
Mm-hmm.
The electric guitar was just a wonderful example of this sort of design, but this sort of technology. And the playing of with power aspect was how the unlimited amount of power that you could get out of amplifiers changed the whole sound of music and the way you play the guitar.
Well, talk to us a little, because Andre Millard, you're Director of American Studies, Professor of History, about the image of the guitar itself, because in another era, we mentioned Benny Goodman in the 30s and the 40s, the clarinet, people like, besides Goodman, Artie Shaw, Buddy DeFranco, any number of people, band leaders, led with a clarinet.
Right, Sidney Bechet.
Definitely. And the clarinet has gone into almost total eclipse, and someone would think now, if someone hauled one out, these you're going to be treated to polka music. So that there's these, you know, Benny Goodman at Carnegie Hall with his clarinet raised to the sky. For those young people in the late 30s, our grandparents probably, that was this cultural image of you know, excitement and great music, and then now it's the guitar and that characteristic pose of we think of a guitar player. What, yep. So there's this big cultural shift in imagery.
Yeah, it's the iconography. But yeah. Remember, between the clarinet and the guitar, there was a saxophone.
Right, right.
I mean, the image of the guy playing the saxophone was a very powerful image.
Yeah, Red Prysock, a lot of those.
Oh, well, you know, but I mean, Charlie Parker and Dexter Gordon and all those smoky 50s clubs.
Those weren't really mainstream culture in many ways.
Maybe not so, but yeah. I think, you know, when we get the first wave of rock and roll, you know, the lead instrument's the saxophone.
That's right. Yeah, in fact, I began playing the clarinet when I was a kid, and my father had great visions of me playing classical clarinet, and I wanted a saxophone, and he wouldn't buy it for me, so I quit. I just quit. Clarinet? What the hell, you know?
That's a hard instrument to master, though.
What, the clarinet? Well, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, the saxophone's not easy either.
No.
The difference is the guitar is a very easy instrument to master.
Is it? Why? I mean, I've kind of picked it up once in a while, but
well, it's simple. You don't have to, you know.
Oh.
You can fret. You can make. You imagine the difference between trying to blow through a reed to reach a certain tone.
That's right.
And just getting your finger on the fret cleanly.
Yeah. Yeah.
The other thing is that you've got the whole, you know, all the scales at, literally at your fingertips. On the fretboard.
Hey, let's. We were talking about gender, and we did mention about a little about race in terms of Charlie Christian, one of the innovators of or the innovator of jazz guitar. Is there does the guitar have a racial?
Identity? Most definitely. It's an instrument of power. It's an instrument of sexuality. The people who created the sound that we associate with the electric guitar were all African American. It most certainly does. You know, that was one of the things why rock and roll was so frightening to the establishment in the 50s. It was an empowerment movement and a movement that embraced diversity.
Mm-hmm. Don't you think now, though, that the guitar is seen as an instrument of white rock and roll culture? Most African American music now is kind of doesn't employ them that frequently.
Yeah, I don't know. I think it depends what generation you're in.
Yeah,
our generation always sees it that way. Because, you know, we remember the great players, because we, you know, Muddy Waters and John Lee Hooker, Albert King and all those. So maybe this coming generation, doesn't see it that way. But I mean, for every Eric Clapton, you've got an Albert King. I mean, in fact, Eric Clapton is kind of another Albert King in a way. I think where African Americans did not take the guitar was in heavy metal. Which is now, you know, probably, in terms of radio, one of the most popular expressions of guitar music.
Yeah.
Would you agree?
Yeah, I mean, I was kind of sorting through that because there is such diversity of music, and it's also niched now that kind of making a general statement is difficult. I mean, I don't disagree with what you're saying. You know, we only have about a couple of minutes left, and I don't think much has been done with the violin in the last 300 years. Does the guitar have anywhere to go?
It does. You think of all the challenges it's weathered. It challenged the synthesizer challenge of the 70s and 80s. The sampler challenge of the 90s, I mean, it's kept pace with every technological development in music. And it's kept pace with every aesthetic, you know, every the way that popular music has developed. So, you know, hip-hop, for example, which you might, on first glance, think is devoid of electric guitars, is actually full of electric guitars. You can't get away from that electric bass.
Mm-hmm, that's right.
And, you know, the people who sample electric guitars. So, yeah, I mean, it's been a very durable technology, and you know, the number of guitars sold goes up every year. More and more people are playing them, so I really don't see any decline. I mean, I see a decline in certain styles of guitar, such as I think we've seen the end of jazz guitar, regretfully.
Really?
Well, I mean, you just don't hear it, do you?
Well, you don't hear a lot of jazz on the radio. Anyways, I just bought a new LP cabinet for all my LPs, and suddenly I started going through all my old jazz LPs. I'm going, oh, my God. I said, when they finally put me under house arrest, I'll be pleased to stay there, listen to my LPs, and read my books. The market giveth, the market taketh away. Look, just one last quick question. We only have about 60 seconds.
Okay.
There's not a lot of instruments that come along. I mean, I'm thinking of the saxophone in the, what was it, like the late 19th century, and the electric guitar. And it's kind of hard. I mean, how can one predict? I mean, what possible other instruments? There was, like, what, the theremin that, you know. Woo-hoo.
Yeah, that was an interesting instrument.
But anything, could you imagine, and this maybe is asking you for too much, I can't. Can you, what, a new instrument?
Oh, there'll be a new electronic instrument, definitely. It'll be one of these multi-function sampler synthesizers. I mean, I don't think we're going to make any new sounds,
mm-hmm.
but I think we are going to make the old sounds in different ways.
Well, thank you so much for being with us. My guest has been Andre Millard, and he is the editor and has several essays in the book, The Electric Guitar, A History of an American Icon. It's published by John Hopkins University Press, and Andre Millard is the director of American Studies and a professor of history at the University of Alabama. We in Birmingham, we could tell that by your southern accent.
This is true.
This is true. That's right. And the book is filled with great photographs, many in color, and it's everything from a history to contemporary reflections on what makes up our music. Thank you, Andre Millard.
Thank you, Peter, for having me.
Thank you for listening to Night Call on 101 WRIF. The views expressed on the program are not necessarily those of the staff, management, or ownership of WRIF Radio. Now, stay tuned for more Riff Rock on 101 WRIF Detroit.
Are you one of those people who watches summer go by through an office window, or worse yet, watching life go by? Hey, this is Doug Podell, program director from WRIF. Our career in radio and television can put you in the middle of all the action and change all of that forever. Here at The Riff, we're out at concerts, parties, all summer long. We just held our 7th annual Harley Fest this past June. One of the benefits of the business is that you really grab summer by the horns when you're a part of it. Make this the last summer you spend cooped up indoors doing nothing. The Specs Howard School of Broadcast Arts gives you the tools you need for a fun, rewarding career in radio, television, audio, or video production. And it doesn't just make for great summers. It's an exciting career all year long. Take the no-obligation tour right now at Specs and see for yourself. Students can graduate in as little as 8 months. Mornings, afternoons, evening classes, they make it really easy for you. The Specs Howard School of Broadcast Arts in Southfield, Michigan. Call 248-358-9000 or log on to specshoward.edu. Hey, don't wait. The deadline to enroll is August 31st. The Specs Howard School of Broadcast Arts. This is where you start.
Financial aid available to those who qualify.
If you've listened to the news at all, you may be confused about the new bankruptcy laws. Some people have even called Wyken Associates because they've heard that it's now impossible to file a bankruptcy. That's just the wrong information. Wyken Associates can still help you consolidate your bills and get a monthly payment that you can afford. They can show you how to stop foreclosures, repossessions, and garnishments. You can do all of this and still keep your property. Best of all, once you file a bankruptcy case, all creditor calls must completely stop. Times are tough, but the experts at Wyken Associates can help. Take control of your finances now and call 586-755-6000. As a debt relief agency, Wyken Associates helps people file bankruptcy under the bankruptcy code. You have nothing to lose and everything to gain by calling them at 586-755-6000. Again, that's 586-755-6000 for Wyken Associates, or visit WykenAssociates.com. That's W-E-I-K and associates.com. You'll be glad you did.
9 out of 10 air passengers agree. Once Bishop Airport is the smart way to fly. But what's the deal with this 10th guy? Maybe he's just holding out for some extra schmoozing. A little more kissing up. Now that's smart. How about AirTran Airwaves A-Plus Rewards Program? Featuring the fastest ticket on Earth. Turn around your air travel minutes lickety-split and use them any way you like. Flint is super convenient because AirTran flies nonstop to destinations like Orlando, Tampa, and Atlanta. And of course, flying from Bishop means less driving, less time to connect, and faster hassle-free travel overall. How's that for sweetening the pot? And if you're still not convinced Bishop is the smart way to fly, just remember, we have a giant human brain as our mascot.
Hey, I'm not a know-it-all, really.
Okay, that's enough. So until we can say 10 out of 10 air passengers agree that Flint's Bishop Airport is the smart way to fly, we'll stop at nothing.
I'll bring donuts every morning. I'll mow your lawn.
Flint, the smart way to fly.
Dinner. Wash the dog.
A-plus reward seats are limited. Blackout dates apply. Taxes and fees are extra.
Labor Day weekend is almost here, and 101 WRAF presents the biggest event of the summer. It's Chrysler Arts Feeds and Eats, a four-day celebration of art, music, and food in downtown Pontiac. Oakland County's premier entertainment festival, featuring an art fair, taste fest, and music celebration all in one. Join 101 WRAF for 200 free concerts on 7 stages. September 3rd on the Michigan Lottery stage, it's Kenny Wayne Shepherd. Plus, check out the Burp Pipe on Friday, September 1st, and 38 Special Monday, September 4th. Also, 101 WRAF is bringing the finest local rock bands to the Detroit News Comcast stage. Show his tastes from 50 great restaurants, plus an incredible art show featuring 185 art exhibitors. Labor Day weekend, it's happening in Pontiac at Chrysler's Arts Beats and Eats. Admission to the festival and concerts are free. Catch the lineup at artsbeatseats.com or call 248-975-8850. Presented by Flagstar Bank, Local 4, Metro Times, Pepsi, Labatt, Malibu Rum, Smart, Health Plus, and Miller Lite. Good call.
Hazel Park, Taylor, and Shelby Township.
All rock with the wind. Made in the Motor City.
I've never been happier in my life.
101 WRIF. Everything that rocks.
Rocks. Close my eyes. Let the whole thing pass me by. There is no time to waste. Asking why I'll run away with you by my side. I'll run away with you by my side. I learned to let go of this moment. Yes. Thank you.
good in the hood, baby.
The Rip Rock Girl World Tour continues.
Show me.
Find out when Rip Rock Girl Lisa will be hitting your town. Log on today at WRIF.com.
You'll get your own girl one day.
From 101 WRIF.
Everything rocks.
Cups on.